Light is all around us. From the morning's first rays of sun to the waning glow of a crescent moon. From the torches of our ancestors to the glowing screens of our mobile devices, light is our guide, our timekeeper, and our guardian. Light shows us where to go and how to move. It teaches us how the world works and how to react. It helps us comprehend our reality. It lets us see. And there's nowhere where this is more apparent than when you're at a concert, listening to your favorite band, and the lighting designer is firing on all cylinders.
I'm your host, Luke Stratton. Join me each episode as I sit down with different lighting designers, directors, and programmers from the live music industry. We'll dig deep to find out what makes them tick, what tools they use to get the job done, and what it means to be a mad scientist, a wizard, and sometimes even a Jedi. You're listening to The Light Side. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of The Light Side. I've got some good stuff in store for you today. But before we get started, I've got a little personal crusade I need your guys' help with. In MA2, there's a keyword called appearance. To access this, you hit assign, assign, assign. And appearance will let you color a lot of the different items on the console. For example, if you have a bunch of different macros in a macro pool, you can use the appearance keyword to change the color so that they have some visual distinction. Well, for one reason or another, you're not allowed to use this appearance keyword on executor buttons. So the result of this is that you can't make a red button on a very expensive lighting console turn the lights red. You can't change the color. They're all yellow for sequences. Now, why this feature isn't implemented, I have no idea. I've asked. I can't get a good answer. But if you're interested in having this feature on the MA2, help me out. Send an email to support@actlighting.com, as well as, and probably more importantly, tech.support@malighting.com. These guys know the guys that work on the new features, and man, this is a feature we'd all love to see. It would save us a lot of time for a festival punt page. You can make all your colors be color-coded. Why you can't do this, I don't know. But we'd love to all see it. So, okay, on to the episode. My guest today is Michael Swally of Twin Designs. He's known for his work with Bass Nectar and Pitbull, but he's also worked for Stone Sour, Big Gigantic, Destroyed, a bunch of other people. I'll warn you, this is a long episode, so don't be afraid to take breaks, pause, come back. I put in some musical interludes to kind of break it up into sections. But rather than breaking it up into multiple episodes, I figured I'd just give it to you guys all at once, and you can digest it at your own speed. So without further ado, I present episode 4 of The Light Side. Smalley, welcome to the program.
Thanks, I'm happy to be here.
You like Smalley or Michael? What's your preference?
Smalley tends to be universally applicable.
Sure, well, that works.
You know, I'm good with it.
Okay, so I came up with a term today when I was kind of sitting in the hotel thinking about what we were going to talk about today. And I wanted to know what you think about it. It's a lighting disopogrammer, which is to be a designer, operator, programmer.
Yeah, you know, multitasker.
Would you call yourself a disopogrammer?
Yeah, well, you know, we kind of are in a period of time where people in the industry kind of have to do almost everything. I mean, you do sound and lights. You know what
this
I mean?
Is true.
You got to get in where you fit in, and a lot of times, you know, budgets are tight, and people aren't necessarily trying to pay for all sorts of stuff. You know, to have multiple different people doing roles. Plus, I'm a control freak.
Oh, that was my angle.
Yeah.
I don't want help sometimes.
Yeah, know? I mean, I love help, and I think that collaboration is an extremely important part of a successful show. Collaboration between you and the artist, collaboration between you and the video operators, collaboration between you and management, you know, across the board, everybody's got to work together. If it's not a team, it's not going to work. But that being said, I tend to put myself into scenarios where I can have as much creative control as possible, whether it's just me being egotistical or whatnot. Like, I need that in order for me to feel comfortable. So yeah, I mean, I like doing all of those tasks. I would say that now, as I'm getting older and working in a fair amount of different genres, that certain gigs require different parts of my skill set. Mm-hmm. I'm getting hired to be a show director now more, where I'm not even touching the light board. I'm not even, in some degrees, not even worried about the lighting at all. I'm more worried about the overall aesthetic and kind of pulling all the departments together to create the end final product.
Sure. So when we're talking about these collaborations,
yeah,
can we talk about some of the key guys in your team right now, like Gabe and the rigger we were talking about earlier?
Yeah. So for me, Twin Design started, it's like three years ago, I think. I was out with Big Gigantic, and Gabe and I had met the previous summer doing Camp Bisco. And, you know, we had kind of kept in contact. We had met a few times before that, but that was really when we had time to discuss stuff. And so I was out with Big Gigantic, and I got a phone call, and it was like, hey, we have this I got this call from Daughtry, and they are looking for someone to come in the next 4 days and time code a show and do all this video stuff. I know that I don't, at this point, have the skill set to pull that off. Do you want to work on this with me? And I was just like, yeah, 100%. That would be great. And really, from that first project, it was the most symbiotic, perfect kind of collaboration that I've ever had. He's an extremely smart, analytical, very organized person. I am not organized whatsoever. I'm a messy creative. I'm a walking disaster. Yeah. It's terrible. But, you know, the whole thing is you gotta play to your strengths and find people that, you know, complement that in a good way. And so for me, with my ADD, if I'm working on a project and I hit any kind of wall, I just stop. Mm-hmm. And it'll take 3-4 hours to get me back in front of a console, back in front of a computer if I'm designing video stuff. So what was really great is we found that he was good at staying a few steps ahead of me and making sure that all the assets and the information and the things I needed were there. And through that gig, we ended up getting, you know, Pitbull's management was seeking a new lighting and video team, kind of production designer at that same time. And so Daughtry's management kind of connected us with them. And we had a month to do, a full arena, you know, U.S. tour, and with no direction, barely the right musical arrangements. And, you know,
was that show time coded?
The whole show was time coded top to bottom. All the video was very specific. It wasn't just swirly stuff. It was, you know, more telling, almost like a movie. Mm-hmm. Using a lot of assets that we were given from his camp. We get all the B-roll and everything from all the music video shoots. But really, you know, I didn't even know how to use After Effects or Premiere to the degree I do now when we started that. And you know, we look back at those videos and I'm like, I don't even know how we made those. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Gabe came in here, we set up consoles and computers, and for 2 straight weeks didn't sleep. Mm-hmm. and did this. And, you know, Gabe at that time was not necessarily as proficient a designer or a programmer as he is now. Since then, he went out with Linkin Park. He's been out with Martin Garrix for about 1.5 years, and now he is the creative director and show director for that. You know, but he and I developed a system where I'm allowed to be creative, and we put the strength in my programming and me operating the shows and doing that, and that the technical implementation of the concerts and all the liaisoning and the emails and all the just massive amounts of paperwork and upkeep that it takes to get these large scale concerts going, he handles that.
So, okay, well, like from an actual tools perspective, that means he's using Vectorworks?
He's using Vectorworks. A lot of times he'll take the stuff I do in Capture.
Is a pre-viz program.
Yeah, Capture is a pre-viz program. And he takes that and we'll put it into WYSIWYG so that we can send
which
out...
Which is WYSIWYG, right?
WYSIWYG, yeah. Which where we can send out better looking renders, and you know, our technical paperwork is something that our company prides ourselves on. Mm-hmm. If you have to actually be an idiot to not get it right.
No, you just showed me some, and it's definitely like on point.
Yeah, it's like,
and I appreciate the attention to fonts.
Yeah, yes. Attention to fonts, yeah. Drop shadows,
yes,
line width and stuff like that.
So just like in a really brief description here, you're in capture making design rig decisions.
Yeah.
And when they're ready, they go to Gabe. He does a Vectorworks drawing and loads it into WYSIWYG, and then you guys actually start programming from there?
Yeah, I mean, some of those processes happen about the same time. So I will go, and a lot of times I'm a big user of taking screenshots on my cell phone. Mm-hmm. So this upcoming Colorado show, Lauren and I have been working on that design together for 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. The design was a big part of creating the aesthetic that he's looking for this. So he was more involved in this than he generally is. But, you know, each part of the process, I'll take a screenshot and capture because it allows you to kind of really see what it's going to look like in 3D and send it to him, and he'll give feedback and I'll change that. And so once myself, Lauren, and management, most especially on the budget end, are at a point where we feel really good and that the vendors have seen everything and we're at a point where we feel good, Gabe will have, at some point in there, take in my loose drawings and turn them into bid paperwork. Mm-hmm. We're really just a front view, top view, maybe like an ISO view.
Mm-hmm. This is going to the vendors directly.
Yeah, going to the vendors directly so we can just get numbers, mm-hmm. you know, to see where we're going to pan out. Because you're talking, these rigs are insanely expensive.
And do you have problems with fixture counts? Oh, we can do this many Vipers, but not this many.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're really lucky to work with a company like Brown Note, mm-hmm. who has been in and out of the sphere of working with Base Nectar and working with myself since 2009. You know, they're a great company. They've got a lot of stuff. If they don't have it, they can get it. But, you know, I try to work inside fixture counts. I want the vendors that I'm working for to make money and to be happy, because we want to be happy. And it's, you know, it's a lot of back and forth. In some cases, they'll be like, oh, are you cool with a Axiom versus a Viper in this place? And then sometimes I'm like, no. Most of the time, I'm like, yes. I would say that of all the people, I am the most easygoing about it.
You mean like all the designers in our little world?
Yeah. I mean, people, I have the things I like. I have extremely strong opinions on fixtures and why I use them. But I would say overall, like, I'm big picture.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to get a huge impact. And if we have to use this type of video tile versus a different video tile, or, you know, we have to use in a certain part of the rig, 101s versus an X4S or something like that, you know, I'll make those shifts.
Yeah.
But in general, you know, a vendor's going to try to get there for you.
Cutting back to your crew, can you fill us in on, I didn't catch his name, but what your rigger?
Okay, so our rigger is this guy, Russ. Mm-hmm.
What's his last name?
He's going to kill me.
We can edit it in post.
Russell Keith is the name.
And what was Gabe's last name?
Gabe is Fraboni.
Okay, Fraboni.
So Russell Keith, this guy is a character in the best possible ways, mm-hmm. but he's just immensely talented, mm-hmm. works with Justin Timberlake and J-Lo, and has been with Base Nectar now, I believe, for 2 or 3 years. He did the Pitbull tour for us, but he did that remotely. You know, he'll do all the advancing and making sure everything goes on the roof, advancing with me on what we may have to cut out, what we may have to adjust, whether an angle on an angled truss opens up wider or closes. And then he creates a rigging plot, sends it to our guy on site, which for Pitbull was Chris Reagan, I think was his last name. And then he interprets that in there, and we have a game plan. But Russ is really good. When we first started working with him, he didn't know us, you know. But now, having been working with him for about 2 years, we have an extremely, you know, positive dynamic relationship where, you know, I'll bounce ideas off of him on whether or not it's going to fit weight-wise into a room, what restrictions. You know, with Base Nectar, we're doing a lot of very unique rooms that have low trim, are extremely difficult to rig in. It's not a stage on one end of the room kind of vibe. And so I need as much information and feedback during the design process so that we're not held up for weeks after I design it and we have to redesign it and then do that. But, you know, Russ is extremely proactive and goes in there and you know, honors the artistic intention and makes sure that we are as close. And he knows, you know, the same way Gabe knows my design aesthetic. The best, honestly, that's, I think, the reason we have such a great relationship is he spent a lot of his early years coming to Bass Nectar shows. He's seen probably some of my prime creative years, you know, early years with Lauren, and understands what I'm trying to accomplish. And Russ, physically now having seen how I design rigs, the choices I make, has an extremely good understanding of where he can make an adjustment that I will freak out about or not freak out about. And he knows when he needs to call me. Or, you know, a lot of times Gabe, when we get to the point of actually technically implementing the show, Gabe takes the lead and makes those choices on my behalf because he knows what I'm going to say. And if there is a question, he'll call me, but that's really rare.
Yeah.
You know, but I also try to make my decisions pretty clear on the first design.
All right, well, let's talk about the Michael Smalley origin story.
Okay.
What's like the beginning? Like, when did you know you were going to be a lighting designer? What was your first big gig? Like, were you one of those, it happened to you on accident, or have you always been messing around with lights?
Nah, man, since I was like a child, my bedroom at my dad's house to this day has a stage built into it. It used to be a recording studio from the previous owners, and so that was like probably one of the prime selling points for that house. I was just like, that's my space, you know? Like, and so, yeah, I,
Do you like bring home like Mac 3s on Christmas to light the tree?
No, but I did used to do Christmas tree lighting ceremonies at the house where I would power each part of the tree off a different power strip and run extension cords all the way up to this balcony we had and like play Mannheim Steamroller and just flip through. I mean, I used to take like six power strips and just run my hands over the buttons in different rhythms and try and do that to bring on different parts. But, you know, my dad's an electrical engineer. And so, and my grandfather's an industrial engineer. So there obviously is that technical kind of like predisposition towards it. I was really blessed to have grandparents that really pushed creativity, the technical implementation of creativity. There's nothing, no crazy idea I wanted to do that they were going to be like, no. So I'd set up, you know, bed sheets and take slide projectors and pull the lens out and use different colored slides to create stuff and do shadow puppet stuff. I mean, we're talking very young age. My aunt, who lives just like 10 minutes from here, sent me to art summer camp every year. So it's always been something I was into, but when it really galvanized was my middle school. The choral program also, we needed lights for the school play and we needed sound stuff. And when you got into eighth grade, you were allowed to audition for the tech crew.
Oh, nice.
Right? And so that, you know, we had a little, you know, NSI Microplex console, and I had, and little, you know, dimmer packs and park hands, and I started DJing the school dances. And so I was setting up, you know, the sound gear and the lighting gear and doing all of that stuff in eighth grade. Then I got to high school and, you know, insanely blessed that I lived in a school district and went to a high school that had the top choir in the state. The music.
You want to plug this school?
What's the name? Roswell High School. Go Hornets. you know, incredible choral program. My choral teacher, Ira Pittman, is by far the biggest musical inspiration in my understanding and knowledge of how music operates and key structure, and just my ear was trained working with that. I was in, you know, a very small, highly auditioned choir that did everything a cappella, and it was, you had to be good at music. But that, you know, we also put on these awesome shows where I would be the stage manager or the assistant director or work with the lighting, and that we had a beautiful auditorium with Source 4 Lecos and, you know, at the time, super cutting edge lighting. And then right across, we had the media tech department where we had a fully functioning television studio with professional grade editing gear.
Nice.
And that the first teacher I had, I can't remember her name because she only worked there the very first year, was a producer at the local news. So she took me in on Sundays and would allow me to edit news packages when I was like a freshman and sophomore in high school. And then later this guy, Mr. Scott, came in and he basically started creating courses because I ran out of courses I could take in there and I still wanted to do it. So he started going and making fake classes basically that I was the only one registered to.
Kind of like independent study.
Yeah, it was all an independent study, and I was a teaching assistant in there and would help. And so I got into video editing, and at that time, nonlinear editing, video editing didn't really exist.
Yeah.
So we got one of these massive systems to do that and started learning that. Now, you know, Premiere and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's a thing of the past. Yeah. But at the same time, I was, you know, putting on different choral things. I was in Latin Club, and I got on like the state board for Latin Club, being the technical person, and basically it was just making their talent shows at Latin Camp look cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was doing all that stuff using at home kind of programs. There used to be this Microsoft program called Visio Home. They probably still have it.
Maybe. Yeah.
But it was like an interior design program, and I would use that to design sets.
Oh, okay.
For the show choir would do a show.
Yeah.
And I would design the set for that. And, you know, I was always just, it was more just throwing all of the stuff out there. It wasn't necessarily lighting over something else.
Sure.
It was, you know, going with all of it. Then I got into college. You know, I wasn't a super cool kid in high school, and I got to college, and all of a sudden, magically, I'm super cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Started going to Phish concerts, and you know,
What was your major?
Technical theater. Okay. I went in on a vocal scholarship. I had two vocal scholarships for singing, and then a technical theater scholarship. But you know, our theater program had maybe 10 students, so it was a lot of super hands-on. Anything you really wanted to try to adventure into and do, the teachers were going to be really supportive of. So I in college started going seeing Phish, getting into that. It shifted very quickly from me wanting to do plays and theater to seeing Phish and being like, oh, that's more visceral. It's more interactive and just up my alley. And so I did the typical thing, and it's weird because now people send me these things. I sent Phish a letter.
Oh yeah.
You know, please forward to Chris Kuroda.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? Like, hey, man, how'd you get into this? What's the whole thing?
And did you hear back?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not. I mean,
well, do you reply to those letters?
I try.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. And I'll say this much. It's just, it doesn't matter all the time how the person you look up to got into it, because every person in this industry got into it a different way.
Of course.
You know, and that there's no right path. What you have to do is care and work hard and just figure it out. I mean, no one taught me how to get to where I'm at. No one taught me how light jockey worked when I first started that. No one taught me. Saxton sat down with me for all of 4 hours to show me how to patch and program a cue on the MA1.
Uh-huh.
By the time I actually took the MA2 class, I already had a show file. It was more just to get more proficient on it. You know, but it's now the internet exists.
Yeah. I mean, I have a thing in one of my videos where I'm going through my show file layout.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, if I could have just seen Kuroda's file, that's what I thought at the time. Like, if I could have just seen it, I could have got such a head start. But the reality is, I didn't, and I did it on my own. And now looking back, if I saw his file, I've seen his file, it's like, cool. That's not how I would do it. Like, you find your own path, and ultimately, that's much more important.
It's massively important. I mean, that's what is going to give you a style.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's what's going to, you know, I look at all sorts of people's show files, and none of them are the way I do it. And they all look at mine, and they're just like, I wouldn't do it that way either.
Yeah.
I personally think mine's a lot easier to navigate than a lot of these are.
Mine's better. So
yeah, there you go. But I mean, I think it is important for everybody to find their own path, do their own thing. And if you're always trying to go and cop somebody else's look, somebody else's approach, somebody else's thing, you're never not going to be that successful.
Yeah.
You might get a job.
Yeah.
You know, you might make money for the rest of your life, but you're not necessarily going to get the big boy gig, and you're not necessarily, you know, going to be someone that people are like, that's a real artist.
Yeah.
You know, it's all relying on your deal. And I mean, I'll be the first person to say that, you know, like people like Chris Kuroda and Saxton were obviously at the age I was and at the time everything was going down. Those are the biggest influences.
Yeah.
They were also at the time the only influences,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, being in the Southeast, Sound Tribe was that band. You know,
yeah.
The Disco Biscuits weren't really on the radar for me at that point.
Sure.
You know, Umphrey's wasn't on the radar for me for years after that. So those things weren't the biggest visual influence for me. You know, you had Chris on the high end, and then you had Saxton using this crazy little high end controller with his techno beams back in the day, you know, but just crushing it with his six options.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I mean, I went and did it myself, and I thought about it for myself, you know.
So did you buy gear or did
Yeah, well, I went for 2 years to a school, Young Harris. It's got 550 students. Now I think it's got much more. It's a 4-year school now. And then I transferred up to Appalachian State.
Mm-hmm.
Their theater program was just not something I was interested in. It was more technical versus artistic. So I went and took out a $5,000 loan. Spent $2,500 of it buying 2 American DJ pocket scans and 2 color 150 RGs and a tiny operator 2 little, you know, shitty DJ.
Really top of the line.
Top
gear.
Of the line stuff. But you know, this was like 2001.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, we didn't have LEDs and we didn't have all this stuff. And that
didn't have on PC.
Didn't have on PC access to that information. And that style of stuff was non-existent, you know? So I bought that stuff. I started doing lights in a local bar called Murphy's, where I would take crank stands and literally duct tape them to wooden railings and push the pipes up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could get all of maybe 20 people into this room.
Yeah.
And, a band called Ghost Train came through and they were awesome. You know, they were like a heavy metal fish kind of thing. And so I was like, sweet, let me be your light guy. And they were based out of Atlanta, and I was still going to school at Appalachian State. So I would drive. They did a residency at a venue in Atlanta that's not here anymore called the Brandy House. And it was like, you know, every Friday for a month in October. And I would drive like 8 hours down, set my stuff up. I'd get there right before they go on. So I'd have to set it up backstage while they open it up and run in and set these things down and run out front and try to do it. And, you know, you'd have to turn off every light in the entire venue and you'd have the tiny little fog machine.
Yeah.
You know, we eventually cut a long extension cord, took the ends off and cut the controller cord for the fog machine. And that was how we got
put
control.
It in the front house.
Yeah, that's how we got all the control to the machine where we could use it.
I mean, I went through so many crappy foggers until I got a bass hazer.
I have a crappy fogger underneath there that Greg and I use when we're doing laser experiments.
Just like just when you're working on stuff.
Yeah.
In the studio, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, 2 years ago for bass lights, Greg had just moved to Atlanta and he and I are best friends, so it was like, cool, let's just get both consoles in the house.
Yeah.
Gabe works with both of us, so Gabe was down here, and for like a month we woke up and it was 8 a.m till 6 p.m every day in here just rocking. And it was super cool because Greg's literally, if you want to know how I program, you take everything Greg does and you do the exact opposite. Right. But it's awesome, you know.
Yeah.
It's great to go and look at how he does it, and him come over and look at how I do it.
Yeah.
And it's
you guys are crazy.
Yeah. We're just like, that's stupid,
yeah.
But it's awesome.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But it's amazing, and you know that experience of collaborating and working together on a rig, and then being together in the same room programming. We had, you know, Lightwave at the time brought out lasers. We had Pangolin in here, and he's programming some, and then we're programming some, and. Mm. It was really amazing, and then we get to go into the concerts, and I get to do a show, and then he does a show, and then he does a show, and I do a show, and it's incredible to be able to have friends like that in the industry to really, you know, bounce ideas off of, be inspired by. That the entire Pretty Lights crew is just crushing it on the regular, and now Greg is on some crazy stuff with his video
stuff.
Yeah, the synthesized video. And you know, it really is a huge benefit that now he is back in charge of all of the aspects visually, because it was probably the best thing that he wasn't for a little while, you know, but now that he is, it's great. And the end product is super unique, and that there's nobody out there that looks the way Pretty Lights looks. Yeah, I just have the utmost respect for him as a designer and honestly as just a friend. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I'd be sometimes if it wasn't you know, for people like him and Gabe. Yeah. You know, that level of support and friendship in this industry is super, super important.
We should definitely do an episode too, you guys.
He thought he was gonna crash the party.
Oh yeah, I mean, hey, Greg, if you're out there,
yeah, come on, hang out.
I got a third mic.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great dude. He's crazy, but he's a great.
Oh,
dude.
He's crazy. Yeah. I just recently got to know Greg. He's an awesome guy.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so what's the first like real gig?
I was working for Ghost Train, and then I went to work for this band, Greenlight Council, and I worked for them for a while, and then I was still doing college at that time, mm-hmm. failing massively at doing college because mm-hmm. I just didn't care at all. And, you know, things get away from you. I was seeing 20 Phish shows a year and mm-hmm. just life. And then this band, Moonshine Still, who was established at that time, they were doing really well. Greenlight Council was opening up for them and stuff.
Like theaters or?
Large clubs. Large clubs. I mean, but they, you know, did some good sets at Wakarusa. They never quite, I mean, I toured with them for, I think, like 3 years. Mm-hmm. But it was living on a school bus, made $600 a month. You made $5 a day per diem. You got 2 slices of pizza mm-hmm. and 2 PBRs.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, and all the PBJ you want and water.
Sure.
You know, the bus had no air conditioning, no heat. It was intense. I learned how to run lights and improvise lights to music working for that band.
Yeah.
The band was incredible. Not a great name choice for the style of music that they played. Yeah. They did not play bluegrass.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe they started out that way, but sure. You know, by the end they were definitely doing a more jamtronic kind of thing. But right about the time that they broke up, I went and worked at Trader Joe's for like 6 months mm-hmm. and then Numa Trio called me and they were hey, you know, like, you want to come work with us? And so I went out on tour with them, and it was a van and trailer thing. It was playing like Newbies in Memphis and, you know, small stuff. And then we'd get to Colorado and be huge.
Yeah.
You know?
They're one of those acts that I think they're a lot of favorite band.
Yeah. You know? You know, and it was really good. And you know, all those guys are amazing, and it's been super sweet to see Alex have such an immense amount of success after that and really find his voice. You know, everybody thinks that they're going to get in a band in high school and that's who they're going to play with for the rest of their life. And it's very rare.
Yeah.
So it is exciting to see that he's had all that. And he is a singular artist. He has a vision and it serves him better.
What's the artist he's with now?
Paper Diamond.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
It went from Numa, then Alex left and did Alex B.
Okay.
Which is a little bit more kind of hip hop ish, and then got a little bit more dancey with the Paper Diamond moniker. But, you know, they were playing in Colorado, and everybody's favorite promoter, Dave Sheldon, was like there, and he was like, hey, man, like, I want you to start coming and doing these parties I'm doing. And one of the bands that's going to do it is Soundtribe's going to play their own after party at the Gothic Theater. And if you were cool doing it, and Soundtribe didn't really know me, but they were like, oh, that's cool. Saxon wasn't going to do it and everything. And so I went in there and Saxon sat next to me and I felt like I crushed it. He felt like I crushed it. And that was really where I guess like the reputation on a large scale started to happen, you know.
Wait, so was this when Saxon was taking a break?
No. This was
just a side party.
It was an after party, and Saxon wasn't going to get there in time to do stuff. Plus he's not going to get paid. It was like them doing a PA set.
Okay.
You know?
Gotcha. Yeah.
And this was, I mean, like 2007, 2008. Okay. And so, yeah, I started doing that. Then we started doing after parties. And then at the same kind of time, Music Matters Productions started up in Atlanta with my friend Aaron Serrero. And then Whit Hawkins, who now works for Pretty Lights as the backline tech. He runs their warehouse. Derek's right-hand man. He does a whole bunch of stuff that I'm probably leaving off. I'm sorry, Whit. I love you. We're still best friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, we started this company where we were taking a restaurant in Athens, Georgia over and after they closed, we bring in all these lights and then we just hire our friends to come play.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned into, hey, we have all this gear. It wasn't amazing gear at the time. It was, you know, Design Spot 250s mm-hmm. and things like that. But hey, we have this gear. Let's start hiring artists we want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So who do we hire? The third one we ever did, the parties were called the Ballers Ball.
Mm-hmm.
I got a bunch of the posters in my room I could show you and stuff. But the first big artist we hired was Bass Nectar. And he came to the Georgia Theater, and he played for maybe 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. It was not the bass Nectar you see now and whatnot, but we started doing that more. We brought Pretty Lights in, his first show in the Southeast we did, and, you know, we just kept doing that. We brought Numa Trio in, we brought Conspirator in, mm-hmm. and it just helped us, you know, one, put ourselves in front of a network of people like that. And then eventually those artists started hiring us for stuff. We got hired to do Camp Bisco from doing that. Echo Project, which was a precursor, it was on the land that Counterpoint and Tomorrow World are on. But it was when Meat Camp was first starting to do festivals in, kind of in the Southeast. So we started doing all that and growing that at the same time as me starting to meet the Colorado people and everything. And then eventually it just parlayed into Bass Nectar calling me. They at the time had a video guy, and they were really trying to expand and have a comprehensive, well-thought-out light show. And mm-hmm. so we actually dropped video completely for almost a year. Mm-hmm. Because that just wasn't something I knew how to do. We didn't have video product. I wasn't going to do projectors and all this other kind of stuff. Bass Nectar was the first big client. But when we first started, it was really, really small.
So you grew with Bass Nectar.
Yeah.
It's kind of a lot like Greg's story, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bass Nectar was the first client that had pretty much, like, money.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a lot of money at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you...
But, I mean, if 1,000 tickets to the Georgia Theater, that's... That's enough for production.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, at the same time, though, Aaron and myself, who own Music Matters, the whole reason we started doing production is we have their music stores to sell instruments and have students. And actually, the lead guitar player from Moonshine Still ends up now he runs all those stores. Mm-hmm. And we started it's a rock band summer camp that Aaron kind of started. It was kind of a school of rock type deal. And so the first year we brought in some park hands that we rented. And the next year he's like, I'm just going to get a loan and get some lights. What did we get? And he got that and Light Jockey. And we started the rest of the year needing to rent it out. So we put that out on Numa. We started doing these parties. But that the music stores were really helping almost fund purchasing this new gear and validating it. Because then we turned this camp got turned into a year-round deal. And so, you know, that's where we started eventually having enough gear to put on something like a Bass Nectar or a Conspirator. And, you know, it's interesting because when you first start, like, wanting to design stuff, you don't have technical limitations.
Yeah.
You'll put a truss anywhere, you know, you'll do anything. And there's a sense of adventure and recklessness to it that I think as you get bigger or, you know, you start more established and having to have more technically sound things that you lose.
Yeah.
A little bit of that
adventure. You mean you lose the adventure?
Well, you start, I mean, at least for me, my box gets narrowed. I'm like, I would love for a truss to be there, but it won't fit, or this motor would have to hang some crazy way, or we might have to do something slightly illegal to make it fit in that room. And, you know, when you're just starting, like, the concept that a truss might fall over and kill someone does it. I mean, we were doing really ballsy stuff, and... Yeah. You know, breaking our, we didn't have ramps for our trucks and deadlifting stuff, you know. You really have to, you have to get in there and it. But yeah, I mean, I think as I've gotten older and having technical limitations, that maybe some of the adventurousness to do just bizarre stuff is kind of left.
Well, you've developed your own, like, style and workflow.
Yeah, but you know, at that time it was really anything goes, you know, and experiment and do odd stuff. So,
well, in such a creative field, though, how else are you supposed to figure out who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and then what works, and you know, there's school programs now and stuff that exist to help teach them this stuff, but really the best way to go learn any of this stuff is just to get out there and do
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
You know?
So let's fast forward. So you did Bass Nectar, and then there was sort of a falling out, and you did a bunch of other work, which was probably a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say.
And now you're back. Like,
yeah, I would say that everybody should have a falling out.
Yeah. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, well, you know, here's the important thing is when I first started working with Bass Nectar, we were doing on average shows from like 700 people to maybe 2,000 people. And over the course of 3 or 4 years of working with him, you get to the point where you're doing, you know, arenas, you're doing festivals where you're in front of 60, 70,000 people. There's a lot more people involved. There's a lot more management. There's a lot more at stake. The relationship between you and the artist is obviously going to get less personal, more distant. You know, there's just things that professionally get involved. And at the same time, you know, you're growing, you know, it's very rare that an artist acknowledges, you know, the art the fact that you as the lighting designer or video designer or set designer or just designer actually have an artistic voice you're trying to get out, mm-hmm. not just they're not the only person.
Right. What do you need? Yeah,
yeah, they're not the only person that has a game plan to put their art into the world, mm-hmm. you know, and has a voice. But it's difficult for an artist to do that, and I don't blame them. You know what I mean? But I would say that, you know, that relationship can get strained when you get to that. And especially at the point, you know, when we ended up parting ways, it was like people were putting hats out with my name on it. You know what I yeah. mean? Like it got distorted, and maybe the egos on both sides got involved. I, for one, absolutely had a gigantic ego yeah. and it was getting bigger and bigger yeah. and bigger. Yeah. And you know, you just get to a point where management's not going to put up with that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just, I think it was an important part, one, for me, you know, I got let go, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't like a mutual thing. Sure. Like I got let go and was super pissed off about it.
Sure.
But it ends up being the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
I was just going to say, man, it seems like it's worked out great for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody needs perspective,
yeah.
you know, and that we also need to understand that the industry is not just a very small, narrow, genre type, and that if you choose to just stay in that genre type, you are putting a ticking time clock on your overall employability. And that I'm 36 now, like I'm getting older, like I'm not always gonna do EDM or mm-hmm. you know, jam bands. Like they're not always gonna be popular. I mean yeah. maybe they will, but you know, I have long-term plans for myself. And then honestly, your vision and what you want to accomplish, it's huge. I mean, I remember for an extremely long period of time in my life that my like end all be all thing that I wanted to do was do lights for Spangle.
Yeah.
I was just like, I got to like, like this is my it's your jam. Calling. Like yeah. this is my, if I could just do it. And you know, then I did.
Yeah.
And now I'm friends with Simon and, you know, all these folks.
What was that, a tour or a one-off?
It was a one-off that Dave Sheldon brought me out. It was the world premiere of, like, Younger Brother Live Band.
Okay, yeah.
And it was out in Colorado. And so it was, like, Spangle played, Conspirator played, Younger Brother played. Mm-hmm. And then there were all these after parties kind of surrounding it. And so we were bouncing gear all over the place doing all this stuff. But, you know, ever since that day, you know, Simon and I have been, you know, great friends. And it's cool. And it's like, okay, cool. I accomplished my life goal. I've done an arena. I've done this thing, blah, blah, yeah. blah. Like you have to, your ideas and what you want to accomplish, keep moving
yeah.
further down there. So yeah, I mean, it wasn't awesome getting let go from a job, but honestly, if you've never been fired,
yeah.
you've never actually worked in this industry. Like it's an important, it's an important factor because there are a few truths that you'll learn from that. One, the fans are not going to pay your rent.
Yeah.
You can be loved by all these people, but as yeah. soon as you're not there,
yeah.
it doesn't matter
people
anymore.
People still go see Bass Nectar.
People, yeah. Yeah, no one stopped going to see Bass Nectar.
Yeah.
None of my friends quit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? None of my friends on the crew quit. They still have to have a job. I've never quit a gig because another person on it got fired or
yeah.
quit.
Yeah.
You know, it's a job and it's an industry. But, you know, also the truth that it's like, you're really, if you're working in the jam band electronic thing and you have any level of success in it, it is so much more geared towards lighting guys and being cool with lighting guys, and that doesn't exist anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
No one cares.
Yeah.
No one is sitting at a Pitbull show afterwards waiting to give me a high five. No one.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, they're like upset that one dancer wasn't lit up properly or sure. something like that. But sure. no one cares. And, yeah. you know, my first gig right after that was going to work with Animal Collective. And uh-huh. then very shortly after that, Stone Sour. And it's like going out on Stone Sour the very first day, I was like, hey, is there a crew room, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, the bus.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, here's a bottle of water. Like, oh, wow. You know.
Harsh reality, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, man, what it does is, for me at least, it pushed the focus on, okay, cool, why are you really here?
Yeah.
Are you here because you want people to like you and because you want the accolades, or are you here because you want to do art?
Yeah.
And you want to uplift people's spirits, and you want to contribute to something that was a huge contributing factor to you. Like, listening to a band like Fish and an appreciation of that and the community surrounding that and the Grateful Dead and all of that changed my life. You know what I mean? Like, I would be a very, very unhappy person if that had never come into my sphere. And that has been the most live concerts, and that feeling you get there has been the most enriching, positive experience of my entire life. And I owe a huge debt of gratitude to all of the artists that I've gotten to see, gotten to work with, to get me to that point. So I feel a very intense sense of duty to provide that to more people. Mm-hmm. And I think that was maybe one of the things that made it difficult leaving Bass Nectar in the beginning, was that those were my people. That was my target market for my art. Those were the people I wanted to uplift and communicate with and contribute to that.
Well, and it was a perfect setting for you because he's an electronic artist with a jam band understanding.
Yeah, you know? Well, 100%, even though he has no actual jam band.
Well, I mean, just like
he has seen all of 1.5 sets of Phish.
Oh, really? But from that, his interaction with the community and his dedication to improvising.
Yeah, well, and you know, the jam band community, as it were, has matured into a much wider range of stuff than it originally was. It incorporates everything from EDM to bluegrass to soul to R&B, you know, blues, all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it is really awesome to have seen that the community and the concept of where we all were with Phish and the Grateful Dead and stuff like that, to take on these new lives and microcosms of little communities. And it's really interesting to see, and especially as I'm getting older now and going to concerts where there's 18-year-old kids that I cannot identify with at all, but seeing them have this awesome, coming of age period of time there, and to be able to be a positive impact on that is an honor. And working with Pitbull, you realize some stuff, because a lot of the kids that are going to the EDM shows, they're not hurting for money.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? For one reason or another, most of these folks are pretty blessed to be able to travel all over the place and just dance around, right? The Pitbull audience is not the same scenario.
Oh, okay.
You know, you are looking at a heavily Latino fan base, as well as the fact that these people are oftentimes saving up 3-4 months of paychecks to come out for one night to see 1 hour and 15 minutes. Not these 2.5 hour thing, not two sets, one set, 1 hour and 15 minute, and they're bringing their kids, and they're bringing their grandparents, and they're bringing everybody, and they are dressing up nice.
Wow.
Because this is a big thing for them. Far be it from me to just have a bad night and just not give my 100%.
Sure.
These people have sacrificed everything to put money into my bank account and to give me the opportunity to go out there and do that. I owe it to them to give everything and to operate at a level of precision that is second to none. No drinking before concerts, no getting your mind loose. You need to sit in there and you need to concentrate for your 1 hour and 15 minutes, and you need to bust out an amazing concert. And even if it's time coded, you still have to have,
you still got to be present. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, when I'm time coding shows and when I'm doing that, my main focus is making sure that the audience is getting their money's worth, and that I'm honoring the fact that those people are sacrificing a great deal to allow me to be in that. And if you don't do that, you're kind of doing it for the wrong reasons,
So how did Pitbull come about, and how did it lead back to Bass Nectar?
I was doing Stone Sour, and they are fantastic dudes. I'm actually going out with them in 2 weeks to go do a 2-week mini tour, and then I'm going to be programming and designing their next show and sending it out with a board op.
Okay.
But fantastic
dudes. Is it a Q2Q show?
Yeah, it's Q2Q. The last tour they did a different cover each night, that was kind of punting.
Punch Pit, yeah.
But there was very little punt built into the show.
Okay.
Even Pit, I have a punt zone.
Just in case
everything screws up and I have to yank time code and we have to go for it.
Yeah.
I was with Stone Sour, and then, I was networking inside that heavy metal kind of thing, and on tour with them was Papa Roach.
Mm-hmm.
Also some of the greatest dudes I've ever worked with, genuine, beautiful human beings that are out there for the right reasons. There's no way you get to your mid-40s and keep going out there and sweating and pushing in clubs and, heavy metal festivals if you don't really love it and really want to push. So I did a couple tours with them, a couple other metal bands, and then came back to do a tour with Stone Sour. And right as that was starting, Big Gigantic called me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out with them and did a tour and then a summer tour. And right about that time was when Daughtry contacted us.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of straddling Daughtry, this R&B artist, Tamar Braxton, and Big Gigantic all at the same time.
So are you at this point, are a lot of those tours, they're Q2Q with an operator? Like, how could you be in all those places?
Airplanes. airplanes in a really...
Well, what would you do when there was a conflict?
Well, it was a really short-lived thing. It was only like maybe a month and a half of that. And then the schedule with Daughtry and Big Gigantic, Tamar was just ending right about that time. So the schedule bouncing around between Big Gigantic and Daughtry just was working.
Oh, okay.
You know, it just happened to be copacetic at that time. And then we got the offer from Pitbull. You know, their management reached out. They were looking for a whole top-to-bottom thing, and they were in a rush. The Daughtry thing, we programmed the entire show in 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
Video content, everything, time-coded, 100% in 4 days. Walked in, first show, press play, and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So their manager was like, yeah, I know the guys that can pull together this gigantic task of your show in a month. That's a lot of time for them. And so we kind of... lied mm-hmm. and said we had a skill set further out than we really did, and we acted as if, and mm-hmm. it turns out that we pulled it off and that they were super, super happy. And then, you know, it was just kind of off and running at that point.
Mm-hmm.
An artist like Pitbull plays something like 200 shows a year.
Yeah.
And he's always dropping new songs. There's always new video and stuff. And so
you guys do that remotely then?
No, I mean, at this point, we don't. We've left doing that, so we can focus on other stuff. We left last October, and then we came back for a little bit in the beginning of January. But it's just not fitting into our long term. Long term plan. And you know, I still have the utmost respect for Pitt. You know, it was a super amicable and good way of leaving. You know, you have to do it the right way.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Be polite, stay until it gets figured out,
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it just happened that, you know, the Pitbull thing was full swing, like constantly all the time. At the same time, Gabe was out with Linkin Park. Mm-hmm. And so, we kind of reprogrammed their show. We didn't design the original thing, but we went back in and re-time coded and redid all the lighting stuff. And then around that time, I think, you know, when I left Bass Nectar, he went through just a slew of folks. He had a good long run with Andy Cass, who was my L2 on Bass Nectar before that. So he was really and he actually worked with Bass Nectar before I worked for Bass Nectar way back in the day.
Yeah.
And was the one who recommended me to work for him. And then I took off with it. But he came back for a little bit. And then they got Kyle Keegan involved. But I just don't think anybody ever really was able to, like, almost like psychically connect with Lauren. Like, Lauren and I have a very real artistic bond.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, when I left Bass Nectar, I didn't talk to him for a year and a half.
Yeah.
I didn't talk to any of them. I didn't go see a show. I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. And, you know, time heals all wounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you're at a good place in your life, you tend to be less bitter about other things. But, you know, he reached out to me. And
well,
was
I mean, you were mentally in a different place, so probably his problems with you are maybe... fixed.
Yeah. Well, you know, he had changed management. There were all sorts of contributing issues, but also Gabe was working for him at the time.
Oh,
and,
okay. Well, that helps.
You know, he was doing some video assistant, kind of coordinating the video content. There is nobody that knows Bass Nectar video audio wise better than Gabe.
Mm-hmm.
He is like a Jedi as far as just he can tell you any song when it was written, blah blah blah, blah, you know.
Wow.
He could tell, I mean, honestly, he could probably tell you something I did with the lights at some random show back in 2010. Okay. Like, he's just a dictionary about it.
Yeah.
But he was working with them and working, and he and I had, you know, by that point a 2 year like very strong working relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And had started this company and everything like that. And Lauren reached out and was like, hey, I have some issues where I can't get my crew to the venue, blah, 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 because it's like three shows in a weekend or something like that. Would you mind coming and covering one of these shows? And I was just like, I don't care, you know, like, even if it doesn't go past that, you know, it's fine. And then that never happened.
Oh, okay. But dialogue had started.
Yeah, the dialogue had started. And then we just started chatting on a pretty regular basis, you know, via text message and stuff, and kind of just getting back into the groove and you know, redeveloping a friendship. Mm-hmm. But at the, you know, at the same time, he had this great guy, Stephen Brody, out on the road with him.
The LD.
Yeah, who's turned into a really good friend of mine. But I just, maybe that wasn't the best
match. You know,
the best match.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. And Brody and I have worked on a few other gigs together, and he's immensely talented and, you know, has all sorts of stuff he's doing.
It's like not having the right bass player.
Yeah.
It happens. You know?
Yeah. And so Halloween was closely approaching, and
is this last year?
Halloween 2015.
Okay, 2 years ago.
And so it was just like, hey, I've got these five shows. It's Halloween. There was an EDC Orlando in there, which I ended up not being able to do. But then it was Bass Lights and New Year's, mm-hmm. right? And he was like, would you be down to come out and do those? No obligation for another year, not me coming back full time, not any of that. Mm-hmm. Come back, let's do these five high profile shows, have a good time, just see how it is. And I came back super nervous. Like, I hadn't even listened to Bass Nectar for 3+ years, not on my radar. I hadn't improvised a show other than Big G, which, you know, was like a club thing, but not like really driving a spaceship.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time. And, you know, like, obviously I'm sitting there being like, do I still got it?
Yeah.
Like, can I really still do this stuff?
And it's not like you have like a whole tour to warm up.
You know, throw and go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to be good. Yeah. And so we kept it really private, and we just announced it like 2 days beforehand.
Yeah.
That way to maybe try to keep the anxiety down.
Sure.
But all these kids are super pumped, you know, because they
that had to feel great though, right?
I mean, it felt fantastic, you know, at least, especially the fan response to see kids that actually had never seen Bass Nectar with me doing lights, but knew that that's what they needed to do to see like the real Bass Nectar.
Yeah, it's like getting the band back together.
Yeah. You know, in fact, he kind of like used that terminology, you know, cause we used to have a group, myself, Whit Hawkins, who now works for, Pretty Lights, and then another guy, Trevor Bone, who does all sorts of stuff.
Trevor's the man.
Yeah, he's a great guy, but we were the three-headed dragon.
Yeah.
So it really was like the band, you know what I mean? So it was really cool, and, you know, I went in, did that Halloween show. It felt like nothing had ever changed. Mm-hmm. I can't say that the following shows were necessarily as succinctly amazing as that, but that was just like, after the show, I was just like, this is...
Yeah.
It's magic, so, you know.
Did you say career highlight, one of them?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely super special.
Yeah.
You know, for me, there was a lot of emotional baggage wrapped up into that. Mm-hmm. It was a huge, it was really like letting a huge weight off your shoulders. And I knew that even if I never did another show with him after that, that I needed that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that could have been closure for me.
That's very cool.
And it was super gratifying. And what was more gratifying is literally before I could even get backstage, Lauren had texted me just being like, I haven't felt like that in years.
Oh, sweet.
You know? So it was cool. And then, you know, Bass Lights came up next. I can't say that maybe that first night, like, I didn't feel that great about it.
Yeah.
And especially after we played first, and then I watched Greg just absolutely do one of the most phenomenal concerts ever.
Yeah.
You know, like I like went back to the hotel and was like, I'm not talking to anybody. I called Gabe. I'm like, I'm not coming in tomorrow till like 10 minutes before doors. Like, I need to go to the beach. I need to like zen out. Like, I felt super, super not good about my stuff, but more just like so insanely impressed by the show that Greg did, you know? And the problem for me was that I was trying to run lasers and lights at the same time, and I am not the laser shark.
Sure.
Lasers just aren't something that, one, we were doing with Bass Nectar at that time when I previously worked for Orm, so it just wasn't as much in my my mind.
Very different.
Yeah, and how to implement them into the show. I mean, I spent a ton of time programming here, but it stressed me out.
Yeah.
And so
you had them all in the MA though, right?
Yeah, they were all in the MA, and you know, I had a little touch screen, and I was trying to channel my inner laser shark, you know, but it just, he's been working with them for so long, you know, and I just started having all this anxiety about the lasers, and it kept me from getting into the zone to run lights.
Yeah.
So night two, Greg played first. And he did a fantastic job. I would say not as good as the night beforehand, which was like sublime. But he did his thing, and then we start our set, and Gabe is standing like 2 feet next to me, and 15 minutes into the set, this kid, like Ninja Gaiden style, jumps over the barricade, levitates like 15 feet through the air, lands, stands right next to me, plants his feet, looks around, pushes Gabe back into the video world, and looks at the MA, Gabe's, or Greg's MA that was set up to the left of mine with all his computers and all his stuff, looks at it and just flips it.
What?
He picks the whole desk up and he just throws it onto three girls that were standing in the audio area, just drops. It's like touchscreens, computers, the console, the lifting, the screens on the thing were completely smacked down onto the faders.
Oh no.
The console was destroyed.
Yeah.
And here's a little secret.
Yeah.
I'm watching this whole scenario go down. We're talking like police, people, the fans are grabbing this kid and beating him up. It's like, it's crazy. Yeah. And Gabe's just like, just look at the show. Just do the show. Yeah. Right? And then Gabe comes up to me and goes, they destroyed the laser node or whatnot. Like the little thing that gets the computer information out to the lasers. And I was, he's like, so no lasers. And I was like, sweet.
Yeah.
And I proceeded to do a fantastic job.
Yeah.
Right? Found out later the laser thing was fine.
They just told you that?
But Gabe just knew I was psyching myself out so bad about the lasers, and that at that time we didn't even feel like Bass Nectar really needed lasers.
You just clicked disable.
Well, no. I mean, it fell. Yeah, it would have had to get plugged back in and redone. They could have done it.
Yeah.
But it was just like, just let it be. There's enough crazy stuff going on. Just let he's in the zone. Because as soon as all that started to happen, and I was just like, just focus. And
I feel like this is like your Matrix helicopter moment. You're like, I am the one. You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, it was a blessing.
Yeah.
You know, and he didn't even tell me for months after, you know, because I think he was maybe afraid of getting in trouble or like something like that. Sure. But it was just like, you know, that's why he's the best working partner ever, because he knows me.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knew that just getting that out of my mind would make it so much better.
So do you watch your work at all?
I try not to, man.
I don't either. I had a conversation with my keyboard player the other day because he was talking about listening back to shows. And I know what I did wrong. I don't need to watch it again. But
I mean, If I'm happy after a show, it had to have been a fantastic show. Because I mean, I don't care. I don't read. I used to care about what people said on the internet, and there was definitely a period of time when I was first working for Bass Nectar, right when Greg was coming up, and you know Saxton was in the mix and stuff. Where all these kids, I don't understand why they feel the need to hate so much.
Yeah.
But they're all comparing all of us. Yeah. And there was this big Pretty Lights versus Bass Nectar thing. Yeah. You know, the first Bass Lights was here in Atlanta. And we had two separate light rigs.
Yeah.
Theirs flew in and theirs flew out because we didn't want to share. And we didn't think the other one had a good design aesthetic. And it was very combative on the crew level, you know.
With you and Greg too? Or?
Well, this was years ago. So we didn't know each other. And it wasn't like maliciously combative. It was just kind of like,
I mean, he called it the arms race. Like,
it was definitely an arms race, which Pretty Lights will win every time.
Yeah.
Because it's just a difference of opinion on where money goes and what's necessary. But yeah, I mean, at that time it was not malicious. It was more, we were pushing each other, but also we were both at the point of trying to make a name for ourselves.
Of course,
but all these kids would get on the internet and just compare apples and oranges, and they'd just be like, yeah, all Smalley does is strobe and use yellow.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that's not true. You know, I have all sorts of colors I like. You know, but
yellow's bright though, man, come on.
Yeah, you know, but if you invest your time in worrying about what the audience thinks about it, it's like you're doing them a great disjustice.
Yeah,
you have to follow your truth and you have to do what you want to do.
Yeah,
and it goes down to sometimes you're not the best person for a certain artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I ran lights for Rack one time, and me and Chris Machete are friends now, but at the time, man, I walked back after that first set and they just like berated.
Really?
I mean, it was just like too much this, too much that, blah, blah, blah. And they were like instructing me how to do lights, and I was just like, we're just not the right fit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, all these people want to critique your stuff, and it just got to a point where now I won't read any of that stuff. I just don't care. I put a picture. Yeah. If I put a picture up of something, I put it up because I think it's awesome and it's emblematic and I'm proud of it, but not so I can get a bunch of likes or worry about all the kids saying it's cool. But it kind of goes back to the watching the videos. Like, I can't go back and do it again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hate... there's some cool, there's some fans that illegally bootleg these shows and film them, and they're sweet enough to send me the videos.
Yeah.
So I'll occasionally like look just to kind of see, but overall, like I hate looking.
Yeah, I mean
back
it's so different too for on our end. Like if the lights were great in this part, and I'm like, oh, that position's wrong.
And yeah, and you start breaking it down, and it's not worth it.
Yeah.
You're not going to get better doing that.
Yeah. How do you get better?
Oh man, that's a hard one.
I know.
You know, because I think sometimes I take for granted the fact that I can hear music in a way that I know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
I just feel music in almost a future tense kind of scenario, and that's a huge gift because you can set yourself up. And you know, with an artist like Lauren, like even knowing the music's not going to help you that much because he's going to have 25-30% of his show is stuff I've still never heard until right then.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how. I know how you get better in the time coding deal, you know, and it's just doing it.
Sure.
Practice makes perfect. I think that my period of time of maybe getting better and growing was a little bit more past tense when Bass Nectar was touring or when I was working with artists that were consistently touring, that got me better because every night you're in it. Now with Bass Nectar, you really have to be good right out of the gate. There's no test drive or anything like that. Now, obviously on a 3-night run, night 3 is going to be way better. Yeah. Maybe in the second set of night 2 or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think how I've started to try to get better is to work on as many other projects as possible.
And then bring those skill sets in.
That one, stretch my capabilities, make me question how I operate concerts, make me question how I view artistic choices that I make.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really it. Case in point, I've been struggling with my show on how right on the drop to have really unique things happening with all the different lights and to not just be strobing or flashing between two colors every time he gets to a wow, 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 wow part, right?
Yeah.
Because that's not what I used to do. It's just kind of one of those defaults. I don't know where it's going or I'm not setting myself up properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and did, I was the show director and lighting designer for the main stage of Beyond Wonderland last month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of house music.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of different types of things. But you're doing it for like 9 hours
straight.
Right,
and you get that drop like every 30 seconds.
Yeah. But after 9 hours of it, you're basically on show 5.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so you're really, and you're trying to not get bored.
Yeah.
So you start really looking at other ways of running shows and different approaches. And then very shortly, like the next weekend after that, Bass Nectar played -0. And I ran the show a completely different way than I would normally run it for Bass Nectar.
Just because you just did a 9-hour house show,
For two days straight, you know, doing that. And then just being like, well, this isn't a really effective way to accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as often as possible, I try to have, you know, something else that's going to help challenge me.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You mean in your creative life?
In the creative life, in the execution of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, anything in life. I mean, challenge is important. You know, I can't get better through practicing with him, you know, because even if I were to put the songs on and stuff and practice just with a pre-visualizer at home, like it's not going to get there.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. I'm having to look for external ways of gaining proficiency and, you know, you can't rest on your laurels. You can't be like, cool, this is my thing, and I'm just going to do this thing. Because if you do that, it's boring, and honestly, you'll get worse.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be challenging yourself. Back when I was working with Bass Nectar, when Andy was out with me, we were on tour for like 2 months, and so we were trying to figure out ways to fill our day. I'd be like, let's try this button, this button, this button.
Yeah.
Halfway through the show, I will have deleted 25% of those buttons, 30% of those buttons, 50% of those buttons, but one or two will have made it.
Yeah.
You know, and those are cool.
One or two didn't get fired.
Yeah. You know, or I'd be like, maybe I want these buttons here and those buttons there. And, you know, 10 minutes into the show, I'm screaming at Andy to move them back.
Okay.
You know, and he's over there on the backup desk moving the buttons back to where I wanted them.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But if you don't try,
yeah,
you know? So I try to do that. And then all of these Bass Nectar hard ticket shows, which hard ticket shows mean like his headlining shows.
Not a festival.
Yeah. They all have different light rigs, very different light rigs.
You mean this year specifically?
Well, I mean, all of them, yeah. Really. People might disagree with me, but what I'm doing is taking the things that work. I'll design a rig and I'll find one part I like, mm-hmm. out of that, and I'll use it a lot. Like 2016 is the year of the Halo. We at Bass Center, we built, you know, two circle trusses, and they had literally 101s all the way around them, mm-hmm. you know, like 90 of them or something. Oh, wow. Like that, you know, and it was all about these big circle things. I was channeling my inner Brickman, yeah. You know what I mean?
It's a popular theme on this show.
Yeah, you know, like trying to have an actual like effect built in my show that's called Candace.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That, yeah. is trying to channel some of these artistic influences, yeah, into it.
Candace Brightman reference.
Yeah.
Grateful Dead fans. Yeah.
She's fantastic.
Yeah. I've never seen her work other than Fairly Well, so.
Well, you know, but the thing is like, I never saw her do the Dead. I saw her, yeah. do a tour with Phil and Friends, here in Atlanta in 2000.
Yeah.
That was hugely influential on just whole concept of lights. They did the most amazing Uncle John's band, and when they hit the jam, it just turned into rainbow madness in there. Uh-huh. But you see a lot, you know, I think that's a really cool thing that you can, Kuroda cites her as his main influence.
Sure.
But really, there's huge differences.
Well, and the technology available at the time she was at her prime is so different than now.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, before YouTube and before all, mm-hmm. that stuff, you know, when I was going in college, I would go to the school library and sit there and save all the pictures of fish or the Grateful Dead. I would just search live fish pictures, yeah. and stuff. And that was the only way we could get a point of reference,
sure.
you know, to establish some of those things. That's why I think that what I draw the most from fish is the geometry of the positions that I build.
Yeah.
I would say that how I execute a show, how I get from point A to point B is probably pretty different.
Yeah.
But
the music's pretty different.
Yeah, obviously. Dixie, yeah. But the geometry of it is something I bring into everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go look at a Pitbull concert, you'd look at that and be like, it's pretty fishy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Chris said one time that I could borrow anything I wanted to borrow as long as I mentioned him in all the magazine articles. And I have actually faithfully done that.
Yeah,
in every,
sure.
magazine article I've done, I've mentioned him. But
so, have you ever worked with him?
I have. We did All Good.
Yeah.
I was working for Brown Note at the time out of Colorado, and they were providing the light rig. So I was the house lighting designer. And it was when Fish still had the circles.
Yeah.
And Chris was coming in to run lights for Phil and Friends. And
yeah.
Chris was actually the house designer.
Sure.
The light rig was based really loosely off that, off some of his designs. But, you know, my job was, he came in with his fish show.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
And it was like, cool, you need to patch this to that.
Yeah.
You know? And I think had I not been so completely comprehensive understanding of the fish show,
sure.
at that point, I would have failed massively.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, I'll give you a few hours. And I was like, I just need like 20 minutes.
You just did a clone?
It was basically a clone.
An MA2?
Yeah, it was an MA2. I wasn't quite at the point with PSR and cloning,
yeah.
and
yeah.
reasons why you do certain things.
The PSR is partial show read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite to that point of understanding. And so, and honestly, the console wasn't quite adept to doing that.
Yeah.
You know, this is 4 years,
yeah.
5 years, because 2011, yeah. or 2012, maybe.
Yeah.
But you know, we came in and I understood what he needed to accomplish from certain factors.
Were you geeking out of it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously. But by that point, we had known each other for a little bit. I had gotten to go to some fish shows and sit out in front of house and stuff like that. But you know, obviously, it's always fun to sit there and,
oh,
you know, one, get recognition from a person that you have such a, you know, that has inspired you so much, and then get to work with them,
yeah.
and then see the inner workings of how they accomplished that. Because
the gears, man.
Yeah, I mean, but how he, you know, we were talking about this earlier, how he sets up his show is just not how I would do it at all. But it goes back to when he was, you know, when he had a guy running intelligent lights for him, mm-hmm. and another guy running a different set of intelligent lights.
The Parcan faders.
Yeah.
It blows my mind, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a huge part of how he's done it. And what's been really interesting is that he may disagree.
Sure.
And Giff may disagree.
Sure.
But I think that him, you know, being surrounded by people like myself, Greg, Saxon, and stuff like that, that almost upcycling some of these things and slowly adding bits of that technology. You can go see his show now, mm-hmm. and you're just like, okay, cool. He shifted it up a bit. Yeah, he's running a show a little bit different now. Sure. And it's super exciting to watch that stuff.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about a rumor I heard that there's this one particular effect on that rig, the circle effect, where for people who don't know, there's three circles in that rig, right?
Yeah.
And there's a where he has the beams kind of all spin. And
what
move.
Do they call it? Like the chainsaw?
Or yeah. Something so, like that. So one circle spins, and as it finishes spinning, it dims off, and the next circle starts spinning. Did you program this effect?
I did not program that effect.
So the rumor is settled here.
No, I did not program that effect. Scott Chmielewski was out as the programmer at that time, mm-hmm. and I believe that is one of his tricks. I think he did it using a matrix and the effect thing. Yeah. He'll never tell the secret of that, but it's a brilliant effect. And I remember getting phone calls from people. The only thing that I can say I ever contributed in any way was I was always really big at putting delay times on my gobo scrolls and delay times on my color scrolls.
Sure.
And that in Chicago at the UIC Pavilion, I was just like, you should definitely make, he was doing this, all the Alpha Beam 700s on the circles. And, you know, that concept of adding the delays so that now the color wheel kind of moved around in a different way.
Yeah, okay.
I told him that, and he used it that night. I don't know if he kept it in the show after that, but he used that night, and I was high-fiving everybody.
This is the venue. This is the place to talk about those kind of little things.
You know? I mean, it's what a blessing to get to go see your favorite band and have the lighting designer be, like, welcoming, you know. Yeah. And he's such a brilliant dude, and, you know, It's interesting to see him get outside the box, and you know, obviously adding video to the show and their approach to that. I'm a super analytical person, so there are parts I like and parts I don't like.
Yep.
He jokes with me about the parts I don't like. Actually, Greg forces him to joke at me because I'll tell Greg, and then Greg will go tattletale on me, and then Chris will come out.
I'm sure there are parts that he doesn't like, that Chris doesn't like too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all, you know, if you're not willing to try it, you know. But he gets the benefit of he gets to try it each night, and you know, he gets a lot of free range with that. You know.
Yeah.
But love him.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the actual design process, specifically with Bass Nectar. But like, what does that look like in terms of time, in terms of creative input with Warren? Like, are you guys sending sketches back and forth, or he tells you what he wants? Let's talk about that for a bit.
It really, I guess, what I try to do, and it's been real interesting because when we first started working for Bass Nectar, it was, you know, right before we worked for him, it was a VJ on stage with him, mm-hmm. and just videos, and it was a party.
Yeah,
it wasn't a concert, right? It had people that were into counterculture, but it was a lot more of a Burning Man
rave kind of thing.
But a hippie rave, like a West Coast, kind of thing. But the jam band EDM thing had not just given it the validity yet, you know. So when myself, Trevor, and Witt started working for him, we're coming from a jam band thing. So we did what we know, and we turned it into a rock show, and we started making it a concert.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to give us all the credit because there's lots of forces that all go into it. But right about that time was right about when the jam band scene really picked him up. You know, he had already opened for String Cheese or played a set break, and he was doing some stuff with the Disco Biscuits and things like that. But this was starting to give it to where every concert was important.
Yeah.
Because he was improvising, we were improvising, there was a community that was building around it. But that's not inherently what Bass Nectar's inception was.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not inherently where he wanted to go with it. He wasn't against going there with it, but
he probably didn't even realize that was
didn't realize it. Yeah. I mean, it was very subconscious. We were doing what we thought was good. He was doing what he thought was good. And then in the end, it ended up being real good. But now he's established. Mm-hmm. And this last year, we had the opportunity to do quite a few gigs where everyone required a very different approach. Mm-hmm. Most specifically was the Atlanta show, where it was in a big conference hall, one level of floor. He did not want to be the focus. Mm-hmm. He wanted to present a concert or present a party and get back more towards where he used to just DJ. And then people just connected with each other versus everybody staring at the stage. And I think it was pretty reactionary to this evolving thing with his scene of the Rail Riders. These kids that have to be right up front mm-hmm. to stare at him waving his hair around doing something when everybody knows it looks and sounds way better about 30 feet back, 40 feet back, you know? But that comes from it being a rock show, the metal influence coming in, these kids loving that. God bless them. If they want to be up there and do that, everybody's got their place mm-hmm. that they like to see a show from. I like to see it from all the way in the very back, sitting down dead center.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in standing. I'm not interested in doing that. I go see a Phish concert. I sit my happy ass down the entire time. You know, maybe if they play Ghost, I'll get up and vibe out. But, you know, so Atlanta was really different for us, and he really wanted to push the folks out. So the original Atlanta design was a traditional bass nectar, one end of the stage. I put a couple little things out in the house, but it definitely was not what the end result was. We got the original thing out, quoted, blah, blah, everything's good. And Lauren's like, no, like, I don't want to be the focus. Right. Yeah. I'm like, huh, like, we take all the lights off you? What do you mean? He's like, no, like, push everything out into the room.
Yeah.
And so we basically did a 360, but without him in the middle. Yeah. We put him on one side. We didn't put key lights on him. There are whole points of the show where we turned all of the stage lights off. I had inhibitors basically for room and stage.
Yeah.
And I turned all the stage lights off to the only thing we're doing is out in the room.
Yeah.
And he didn't, the first night he didn't play, he played a lot of old school stuff that he hadn't played in a really long time. He mixed them all in cool, interesting ways. For me, it was really fun because it was a throwback to the time when I first started working for him. Mm-hmm. I have kind of like a photographic memory for music. So as soon as he started, I was like, oh, I remember that one. I remember that one. Yeah. It was a great comfort zone, and that we approached video differently. Yeah. We didn't use any of the videos that are synced up to his songs. Everybody was improvising 100%. We had a lot more impact on lasers than we normally had. And it was really cool because I think we discovered what bass nectar is now.
Yeah, okay.
And it gave us the ability to do a rock show, do a party. And the whole thing was designed around giving us the ability to accent the various styles that bass nectar represents and to try to create an experience that is distinctly bass nectar. It's not something we put on it. It's not something he came back to it. It is a matured, new approach to how he presents his music and his concerts. Mm-hmm. And so for me as an artist, I was like, sweet. It was really hard to get me out of that box. I mean, it was...
Yeah, of course.
They knock down, drag out conversations about this. Not arguments, because we don't argue, but like, you know, very strong opinions being espoused. And, you know, it just wasn't what I was into. And then we did it, and I was just like... This is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, it pushes us in a different way.
When was that?
This was last year. Yeah. I can't remember. I think it was like near the end of the summer, like September or something like that, when he played in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. But it was really cool. And then, you know, we went to Halloween, and that's a standard approach again. You know, we brought some of the Halo into the rig and used basically the Halloween rig from the year before, but just updated it. Mm-hmm. And then we went to New Year's and did a full 360.
Yeah.
But brought in some of the concepts we've been doing throughout the year. But then when we got to 2017, you know, the first real hard ticket show is this Atlantic City show next week. Mm-hmm. And that Atlantic City is just like Atlanta, but just huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's an extra 5,000 more people. The space is twice to three times the size.
Yeah.
It's a daunting task to fill up that amount of space, make it impactful. But, you know, a lot of the bass nectar shows this year are in the vein, even if they're not in a room that necessarily is like the Atlanta room or the Atlantic City room, they're in this vein of what we're trying to do is Lauren can be the rock star at these festivals all the time because we can't do something different there, you know, but we're given this opportunity with this hard ticket shows to really every single one of them make absolutely unique and special, and there will be themes that tie from one to the other just because I like them.
Yeah,
you know, if I like a light in that configuration, I'm going to do it over and over again. We found that we really love this downward facing video cube thing.
Yeah.
So we did it on New Year's, super successful.
Kind of like a reverse pyramid.
Yeah, I mean, it's just video facing down to the crowd. So when everybody's looking around, they can look up and see video pointed at them.
Okay.
And we did it on New Year's, and I think of all the things we did, that was the most complimented. I got the most comments back from people about that. So that's something we like. Lauren loves it. I enjoy it. It is a pain to build, but that's not my job. And we have people that have developed a system to do it really quickly. But yeah, I mean, the initial design process is we're going to look at the show. We're going to look at the aesthetic of that show and the aesthetic of the room. We're trying to create, every room we do is different. Very few arenas now, you know, and even something like a Hampton Coliseum versus, you know, another arena is wildly different in how they're physically put together. Yeah. But I try to service the room and the aesthetic of that event really specifically.
Yeah.
So the AC thing is an extension of the Atlanta thing. So I'm using that warehouse aesthetic, you know, most of the stuff out in the room, very minimal stage presence stuff. Mm-hmm. The show that is happening in Colorado later in the year is a complete 180 from Bass Nectar. I mean, no drops, none of that. So there's not going to be a strobe light anywhere in the rig.
Oh, wow.
Or normally I'd have like 40 of them, you know?
Yeah.
No strobe lights, no blinders, a completely different thought process. But, you know, I'll go in there. I do a site visit generally. I'll go in the production manager, sometimes the rigger. Lauren is very rarely involved in that process. He's already seen pictures and stuff of the room. So he's approved it. But I go in there. I generally try to get as many ideas as possible. You know, out of one idea, I might make three or four different iterations of that, where they're thematically kind of the same, but they just have slight changes. And then I try to at least come up with, like, between Gabe and I, we'll come up with, like, two, three, or four of them that we really feel...
Like actual sketches?
No. I do everything capture.
Well, I mean, but yeah. an actual drawing, when you say an idea, you have a picture to show, Lauren.
Yeah. I mean, we 3D models, fly-throughs.
Yeah. We can do lighting cues in it.
Yeah, but we don't.
Okay.
We don't, because what he's a lot more focused on generally is the structure.
Okay.
You know, for better or worse.
Sure.
He cares about the structure and not, so he knows I'm going to make it look cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he's very literal.
Yeah.
And he needs to see it, like, to scale and everything like that. Yeah. And so we'll generally come up with two or three ideas. We'll send them out to everybody, management, production management, tour management, and Lauren, and get feedback. Lauren tends to be extremely direct and very specific with his, and he tends to use no filter. So you have to kind of put your big boy britches on and get ready to hear something that you think is amazing be told that it's shit. Luckily, that hasn't happened in a long time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does. And you just have to take it that it's not that it's shit. It's just not in line with what he's doing at that time.
Sure.
And, you know, you never know if you don't put out those ideas. So for the Colorado show, we submitted three designs. All of them.
This is the Colorado Freestyle event.
Yeah, Colorado Freestyle event. I submitted three different designs. I think all of them are some of the best things I've ever done in my career. His response was, wow, these are fantastic, amazing. You have done the best job.
Yeah.
I don't want any of them. You know?
Oh, man.
And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. But, you know, you have to, you know, as a designer working with a client, you need to learn how to ask the right questions.
Yeah.
You need to say, hey, what part do you like?
Yeah.
It's a very important question. What point do you like? What parts don't you like?
Sure.
And be okay with that feedback, because at the end, they're the ones paying you and you are supplying a product. You know, it doesn't matter if you really feel compelled by something. You can fight for it.
Yeah.
But listen, you know, it's really important. And then listen to everybody's input. I mean, I used to be really all about, nope, I got it. Don't care what anybody else has to say with it. All y'all's opinions are terrible. It's just... it's only me.
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, I've realized that in order for me to, and in order for, I think, most artists to be really successful, they need to be able to listen to criticism. They need to be able to listen to it for what it is. And in, you know, the spirit of what it is. And that you know, other people have great ideas and other perspectives, and that that can not only enrich your design, but enrich your overall approach the next time you go out.
Yeah.
You know, I love working with Gabe because, one, he and I have a very honest, blunt, you know, conversation with each other where we'll send screenshots back and I'll be like, I hate that. That's stupid.
Yeah.
You know,
what were you thinking?
Yeah. You know, but you know, or, and I'm more hateful to my own designs.
Sure.
I'll put something out there and I'll send it to him. And then before I ever send it to him, I was like, but I hate this. I hate this. I hate this. I hate this. How do we make that better? But you know, it's like the pen to paper thing. If you don't put that first trust there,
yeah,
you know, you're never going to get it. I mean, I will stare at a computer screen for 4 hours straight.
Yeah.
And never do anything. Once you put that first trust down,
now you're moving.
Yeah, you have something. You know, put the floor down, build the arena, like put something in.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes, for me, I'll build a shape that will inspire surrounding shapes, and then I'll delete the first shape.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Negative space.
Yeah. Or puts, if all of a sudden now I'm like, oh, all the surrounding stuff's really cool. I've got, you know, to really rethink the thing that's in the middle. I like centerpieces. I'm really big on centerpieces.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Base Nectar, really from year two of working with him, a big push for me was these chandeliers. I've always had little, like, things on the side. His first headlining Red Rock show was, in our mind, what we thought was, like, a big chandelier. It was a double segment kind of thing. It's actually what the hat is based off of. So it's been a theme that we've always played with, is these kind of, you know, small, interesting shapes, layers, stacks of stuff. But I mean, we, for New Year's, we came up with like six different chandelier options.
Yeah.
You know, Gabe came up with a whole bunch. I came up with a whole bunch to try to find like which one looked the neatest.
So, I mean, is this kind of the thing where he goes through with a pen, kind of like George Lucas would, and say, yeah, I like that one, I don't like that one, or?
No, it's screenshots.
Okay.
I send him screenshots. Yeah. Certain things he's a little bit more involved, like this Colorado thing. It's super important that the aesthetic is perfect.
Yeah.
What he's trying to pull off here is different than anything he's ever done, or at least anything he's done in the last 10 years. It's really going to be an interesting new experiment in what we can do. So he's been super involved.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so the current design that we have was built over the course of 2 days of just probably like 60 screenshots.
Yeah.
You know, of me doing this, flying it through a little bit, him being like, yeah, I like that. I don't like that. Can we move this here? You know? So it, you know, unfortunately he's on his cell phone a lot. It's going to be that way.
Yeah.
And if you send, and it's important to be, for me, it's important to have real time feedback because he could look at a fly through and not get it.
Yeah.
You know, versus each little depart, like each little segment of it, I can say, do you like this?
Yeah.
No, like, how do we tweak that little section?
Sure.
Okay, cool. And, you know, by the end of it, we get something that everybody's happy on. And then there's, you know, it's always good to try to get in front of the artist. And thankfully, with our software, I can sit there in front of the artist and move it around.
Yeah.
And they can point at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Be like, I don't like that. Or can I see what it looks like from right here? And you can zoom in and be in that little seat and see, you know, the vibe.
Without sharing numbers, can you share how this kind of process works with both Pitbull and Lauren from a financial perspective? Like, how do these jobs, are you like on salary for the year, or is it per gig? Like, what can a younger designer expect coming into that business model?
Both are different.
Yeah.
You mean
Pitbull and
Pitbull and Base Nectar. With Base Nectar, I'm on a non-exclusive retainer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm guaranteed the whole year.
So you could just work for him as projects need. You don't have to worry about like, oh, I didn't spend enough time on this, or I spent too much.
I mean, the expectation is that I'm going to 100%.
Yeah, deliver.
Be badass. You know what I mean? And however, if that takes 10 minutes and I can do that, cool. If it takes, you know, every waking moment of my life for a year, you know, you sign up for the deal.
Sure.
You know, retainer deals are difficult to get.
Yeah.
They're difficult to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I think they do give you a level of security to where you can just focus on the art part of it and not worry about where the money's going to come from. I would say that most folks shouldn't necessarily quest for that.
Yeah.
It can be very difficult. It can tighten your year down.
Yeah.
You know, like I can't take any gig I want now because I have to make sure it doesn't interfere with these dates and that he could add a date and I'd have to be there.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's you could structure it a whole bunch of different ways. But retainers are cool if you can get one.
Sure.
I would not expect one.
Sure.
It's, he's the first artist I've ever worked with where I had a retainer deal, and it's been years in the making.
I have to think, though, that that helps the creative process. That, like, for me, if I'm going to take a side gig, I have to bid it. And if their rate is not high enough for me to spend the amount of time, I have to make a choice to either spend my own free time or not deliver. And that sucks.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely helps the art.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, I know I can eat today. I know I can eat tomorrow. I know my rent is paid for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
If I only did base nectar, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
And happy. Yeah. You know, and it's not even necessarily the money part. It's the or the amount of money. It's the dependability of it. You know, it's always going to be there. And it you know, an artist should hopefully if in a retainer and you know, neither side's going to be happy.
Yeah.
They're going to pay more than they want. You're going to get paid less than you want.
Sure.
But in the end, what it's opening is that you're not having to have a conversation about that all the time.
Yeah.
You're not been out of shape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So how's that? Oh, go ahead.
You're always going into it, you know, being like, okay, cool. I'm being adequately, you know, paid for the, by this. I'm going to put the time in. And honestly, in our genre, the jam band EDM thing, it just puts the focus back on, it allows you to be like you were when you were younger and you were just doing it for fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, obviously there's a lot more deadlines, there's a lot more, you know, things. The contracts will say specifically how long you have to complete a design.
Yeah.
You know, it puts the pressure on, but that's also a great motivating factor.
Sure.
You know, with Pitbull, it was show to show, you know, you have a rate, you have a week rate.
And you have like an operator rate.
Yeah, we had an operator rate.
Yeah.
And so that was your day in, day out rate. And then we, you know, have a rate to design the show.
So that's a flat rate that the management and artist pays you to do all the design process we just talked about.
Yeah, the whole design process, you know, and it could be a substantial amount of money, but your deliverables are pretty intense, and it's like a one-time kind of
thing. Yeah, and that includes the programming as well?
It depends on how you structure it. I mean, for us, what we ended up doing is, because for Base Nectar, we were the guys.
Yeah.
You know, we designed the set, we designed the lights, we designed the video, and all the and made all the content and did everything. So we were the one-stop shop. So videos, you know, it's difficult because, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into just changing pre-existing videos to fit a different kind of LED arrangement or something like that. So, you know, you end up working out what your rates are with the management. They're either cool with it or not cool with it.
Yeah.
Most of the time they feel like they're overpaying you, but they don't understand how much work it takes.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, with Pit, it was a day rate for the shows and for operating, which is almost a separate kind of concept.
Sure.
And then it was generally, big one-time payments to get the Vegas residency set up, you know, and that's not even necessarily changing the lighting. It's just adapting it, you know, or, hey, we're going on a tour. We did one big lump sum versus here's how much it is to do the stage design and the paperwork. Here's how much it is to reprogram. Here's how much it is. We're just like, cool, you need to pay us this chunk of money to have a concert. Mm. I would say that every organization is different.
Yeah.
Every management company is going to approach it differently.
Yeah.
Every artist is going to be involved at different levels. Sometimes it's super frustrating, you know, with Pitt, he would give input sometimes and then no input other times.
Yeah.
So you couldn't expect input, but you needed to be ready to adjust very quickly if he gave you it.
Yeah.
You know? So you try to, and a lot of times it's trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's finding that your aesthetic matches what their aesthetic is and trying to, keep consistent.
Yeah.
You know, we designed with Pitt, we came up with an extremely specific approach to video.
Yeah.
And every video we did for the next 2.5 years was in that same line. They looked different, the content was different, but the approach and the overall aesthetic we knew worked for him and that he was super happy with it. So why change it? You know, with lighting, he didn't care that much, I guess. I mean, he knew it looked good and he was happy with it, so it never really thing. Most artists, I think, because video is so literal, that they tend to have the biggest concern about that. I would say with Base Nectar, one of the biggest concerns is video and how all that kind of matches up. We have a great team that, you know, makes all of his videos now, and you know, it's synced up. And honestly, I used to do the video back in the day, and it's the biggest weight off my shoulder to not even have to deal with it. I do the design where the video walls go and how they look, but when it comes to content, we have brilliant people.
Team for that.
And they're all amazing and awesome folks.
What's your ideal ratio? Let's talk about maybe not even for Basemaker, just in your mind's eye. What's the ideal ratio of video to lighting on a show? Like, if it were up to you, if you were the artist, would there be no video?
No. I mean, I like video.
Yeah.
The thing is that lighting and video, and one of the reasons we call ourselves Twin Designs is that we're trying to take those two worlds and bring them together, you know, and present a product that is better than the sums of its parts. You got it. But, you know, you have to make room for lights with video. If you're just pounding video all the time, the lights are kind of pointless. You have to create zones where there's no video.
Mm-hmm.
You have to create times when you have to create negative space in the video content. You know what I mean? So with Pit, it was really cool because I made all the videos. So I knew already what I was going to do with the lights. Because as soon as I hear a song, I know exactly what color combination I see, you know, that one's going to be magenta and yellow, blah, blah, blah. And okay, cool, there's going to be that drum roll and then that hit. He's going to say that phrase and it's going to be a blackout. I'm going to do this with the blind, blah, blah, blah. And so I can build the video content around where the lighting's going to be. And I can create that vibe. It's a little bit more difficult with Bass Nectar because I don't control the video. I don't know what the videos
are. There's another guy.
Yeah. We have Max Chang and Peter Sistrom who run the videos and handle the UNS, which is the media server, touch designer, custom media server we use that integrates with Lauren's.
Yeah, so it plays at the right time for certain tracks.
Yeah, well, it allows him to stretch tempo and morph, and the video stays online. It's super fancy and nerdy, and I just can't even try to understand it. It can send, but the UNS can send out time code, it can send out MIDI triggers, it can send out all sorts of stuff. So on New Year's, we actually had the UNS sending the master BPM to my console, and that my speed faders were actually doing just incremental stuff. No, it was doing one quarter of the BPM, one half of the BPM. So all my effects are super synced in with the actual BPM, and I'm just deciding if it's fast or slow inside that construct. And we did that using the audio in to the desk.
Oh, okay. So it's actually a BPM sync.
It's literally just like a beep, beep. But when Lauren shifts it, it speeds up, slows down, and the effects do that.
Yeah.
Not all effects work great on that. Movement effects do not. Combined effects with movement and intensities and stuff to create, you know, like interesting, you know, sweeps and stuff does not work really well with that. Those tend to need to be at a very specific speed based off what you're trying to accomplish. But with Bass Nectar, it's difficult because, I don't actually know what the video content for all the songs looks like. If he plays a random song, he might pull this video from there, blah, blah, blah.
Do you have to, like, punt color match that on the fly, or?
I mean, you know, me and Max, it took us a while. Max is the day in, day out guy who runs that. And there's a lot of the Bass Nectar video show that is punted and improvised. And so we've found a really good rapport and that we're both paying a lot of attention.
That's good.
You know, if he goes to red, I might not be on red right when it hits, but we'll go there. But we also have a super nice in-ear monitor system and communication system to where we can talk about it. And I can sit there and be like, if I hear it coming, I'll be like, all right, cool, let's go all red. Or I'll be like, video, get ready to black out. We're going to go to lasers.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and so we try to, you know, because on top of being the lighting designer, I'm the show director. So there is this element of having to tell the laser operator exactly where what I want and when he needs to do it. We cue effects that way. But it's a super symbiotic thing. There was obviously a time when we first started talking, you know, about me wanting to be in control of all the elements. But I realized that there's elements I can't control and still have them be amazing. I can't control lasers and then be as good as they need to be. I can't control video and it be as good as it needs to be. And so really what you have to shift is how you verbally communicate your ideas to people, especially on the fly. It's very difficult for me to communicate and punt lights at the same time. I can't speak. You know, words just go right out. But you have to, have to figure that out. But you're more like, what I try to do with the lights is be the glue between all the different elements, you know, like the video and the audio may not have even though they might be paired up and stuff, there's a need to you know, blend those two layers. And so I try at least, and a lot of, you know, I get these jobs being the show director at like the base pod at EDC or at Beyond Wonderland or something. And, you know, I'm working with lighting designers and, video people and laser people that I've never met before.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're all going to come in there wanting to do, accomplish their own goals. And so I look at myself almost as like a coach.
Yeah, sure.
Trying to pull the best performance out of those individuals. And that I found that my light board is a really good way for me to do that.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's like jazz. If someone has a really good idea, you need to let that person shine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if the laser guy's got something to say, let him say it, yeah, and then you accent it, you know? So I tend to, at least in those scenarios, and I try to, with Bass Nectar to some degree, allow some of the other aspects to set the tone, and then me guide that tone into maybe our next segment.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Lent the video person, if the video person hits a color, why argue with it?
Yeah.
If they hit red and I thought it should be blue, I mean, I could do blue all day, but who?
Yeah.
Then we both look like jerks.
Yeah, and who's going to know the difference?
Yeah. Yeah, you know? So I try to hit it on the color they hit it and then pull in towards a new area.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, let the laser guy set the tone for, you know, what kind of color he's going to do on that particular drop, and then try to ease into it.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
But everybody on your team's got to have that open mindset and really be visually aware and on top of it, or it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, I mean, I try to use the lights to kind of bind everybody together or slowly push in a certain direction.
All right, let's head to Nerd Town, if you will. One of the things I really wanted to talk to you about is time coding.
Yeah.
Because I don't know anything about it. I mean, I've opened up the time coding dialogue thing in MA a couple times. And I'm an MA dealer. Like, I know a lot about MA. It's just not in my world at all.
Well, so I guess until you have to use it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm with a jam band. We're a jam band. You know, maybe it doesn't always sound like that, but that's definitely the aesthetic, if you will.
Yeah.
So, like, what's the 101? Give me, like, the 30-second crash course on what that is for people who have no idea.
Cool. Well, time code, SMPTE time code, it's basically an audio signal that changes frequency at such a minutia, but over a course of time to where, like, this particular frequency equals this time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, like that's like 3 minutes. You know, but it's the most irritating sound on the face of this planet.
I didn't even know that it made sound.
It's an audio line.
Yeah,
And so basically that audio line just tells you where in space you are. And so what we do is, you know, it's one channel that the playback guy plays out. They'll have, you know, all the other playback parts. Maybe it's just a click track with some backing stuff. But that line, audio line, is sent out of their audio interface or whatever thing into your console. And your console's like, cool, we're at this space and time. And then basically what you're doing is recording your button presses.
So it's actually like you build a punt page and then record the punt page presses?
That is an option.
Yeah.
It is 100% not how you want to do it in the long run, just because time code takes priority over everything else you have going in your show. So if you have accidentally tapped the fader and it's recorded in a time code, it's going to keep it there and it will fight you. It will physically push back on your hand as you push it up.
Yeah.
And if you press a button, it won't go
if
there's information elsewhere in your time code. So it's a high priority situation.
Okay.
But it is a way to have the exact same show play back the exact same way every single night.
Yeah.
So there are some benefits and some, you know, challenges to that. The benefit is that you can do things that are impossible for you to punt. Mm-hmm. I will never be able to punt the level of proficiency that I can put into a timecode show. So it allows these beautiful, intricate things. You can hit drum hits. You can all these little flares and stuff that on your best night,
yeah,
you dream of doing.
Well, so technically, how does that differ from just doing a cue stack?
Okay, well,
like, because that's where you lose guys like me. We're like, okay, I can cue stack it where I hit the button at the beginning of the verse, and then all the hits happen.
Yeah, it's more precise.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course,
because you could actually go and make a bank of buttons, and that's this strobe, that strobe, that strobe, and you can just play it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and actually get it really in tune. Versus you writing in a cue stack, you having to try to figure out, oh, that's 0.25 yeah. seconds, and this is 0.3, and then yeah. this is this and that. Even that being said, my time codes are extremely simplified. Mm-hmm. We have one time code that is the cue stack, one time code that is the video trigger, one time code that is special effects. Then some of them may have little flares and flourishes, but it is extremely minimal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I... one, don't put a lot of those things into shows. I'm not, you know, Corey Fitzgerald, who's just incredibly talented and does insanely intricate time-coded shows. You know, he's the designer behind Bruno Mars. He did J-Lo. Pretty sure he did Beyonce's last deal. But it's all quintessentially these super intricate flashes and hits and all these little things, and every little moment of the thing is accentuated, and his time codes are built that way.
Yeah.
You know, and mine just aren't, because I one of the downfalls of time coding is that it looks robotic.
Yeah.
It lacks a backbeat. It lacks breath. It's really, really, really tight, right? I hate that.
Yeah.
I like watching those shows sometimes because they're just like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever get a chance to go see J-Lo's show in Vegas, like, yeah. you have to. It is, there is one, the Latin section of it, they bring these, what they call, I guess, they call them jam pods or something like that. They bring these down, and it's dots and magic panels, and yeah. it is some of the most insanely proficient, beautiful program you've ever seen in your life. Your jaw yeah. will drop, and you might cry a little bit, you know? But, like, that's not me.
Yeah.
You know? So when I time code shows, I'm trying to make it feel like I'm running it.
Yeah.
Right? But I have and for us, we start, and it's all just a cue stack. I do everything in a cue stack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally all one solid line, and it could be 700 cues.
Oh, and then the time code tells it when to go to the next cue.
Yeah.
Ah, right. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense.
So I'm writing the cue stack. That way I can play the song over and over and over again, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But I write my cue stacks with really intensely intricate delays and fade times in them.
Yeah.
And when I first started, I would have to, you know, create the scene and then go back and figure out how it would fade into that.
Yeah, sure.
Now just with the level of proficiency with it, I'm doing it as I'm going. Now, it may come off as really sloppy, but I just know, like, I want these lights to move at 2 seconds. I want the color to hit on at, like, go at 3 seconds, but it needs to delay 1.5. Like, mm-hmm. I'm building all of those things in as I'm activating those parameters.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as I hit red, I'm telling it how long it's fade there. But I mean, I have things that are like 60 second long fades. Mm-hmm. I have things that are 2 minute long fades. You know, but it's all for me. I want to try to recreate what it's like when I hit the position, then the time it takes me to hit the color, all those things that I have naturally as a punter gotten into having it. So it all hits on the beat.
Yeah.
I want it to look like that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know? So a lot of, you know, the downfall of a lot of time-coded shows is it hits on the beat.
Yeah.
It hits on the beat, and the buildup that was happening, that little cymbal rush yeah. or the, you know, the double time that the bass player might accent the build to it, it's not there.
Yeah.
Right? So I put that stuff in there, and I think, you know, it's one thing that makes my time-coded shows look different.
Yeah.
It is a huge pain in the ass if you have to try to, like, reverse engineer it or yeah. adapt it. Time coding is so much better if it's the same rig every single day, the same choice every single day, because you're locked in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you have these three lights come down for a solo on that player, but you play a festival and they don't have those three lights, yeah, then yeah. your show looks bad.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword in the fact that it's great on tours. It's a great practice. It will elevate your programming skills.
Sure.
It has massively impact the intricacy with which I write cues for Bass Nectar and the proficiency and speed with which I write those cues.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've with Pitbull, it makes every other show you do off tour stressful.
Yeah, I can
imagine. And really not.
So do you try and clone out of your time code, or do you have to go back in and reprogram?
I switched my approach about a year and a half ago on how I bring stuff in, and it's because I learned how to properly PSR, partial show read. What we do now is, and Pitbull's a little bit different, but you know, like I said, we have a Bass Nectar show file, and he plays festivals 75% of the year. So I have all my layouts and my views on how the show's set up, and all of my things are with channel numbers versus fixture numbers, because 9 times out of 10, these festivals are going to put theirs in the fixture number deal.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But everything's in channel number deal for mine, and then I'll open their show file generally, and if it's not in the fixture thing, I'll move it all over to the fixture side and leave the channel open. So I import it in, so now I have both sets of fixtures. I have my stuff and their stuff, and I will just build layouts with their stuff, you know, and I'll pull the plots up and I'll just build it exactly, and it's quick and it's dirty because I'm only doing the show once and it doesn't matter that much. And then I pull up my cloning. And that's when I go, okay, cool. I have this layout on screen one, their layout on screen two, and then my cloning window.
Yeah, okay.
And I go, these lights equal those lights.
Yep.
Go, those lights equal those lights. And I do that. And then I will oftentimes, I'll go back and clean up my group assignments. And, you know, make sure I can functionally get on site and do positions really quickly. You know, I don't put groups into my layouts anymore. There's that little square.
The X keys?
No. You in your layout, you can make a square.
And
if you put fixtures inside that square
and
you hit that square, it grabs all those fixtures.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So I go and I do that. For my downstage truss, I just put a rectangle around it.
By pressing the actual square, it slips that.
And there's really cool ways of doing it because you could make a little square that kind of comes out here and has just a tab.
Hangs over,
So you can create multiple different groups in a much smaller...
Yeah, and there's no reason to waste a bunch of weird numbers.
So I don't. I very rarely now create groups.
Okay, so back to the time code. Like, if you have a problem, like, how do you stop it? Or how? I guess more I want to ask, how do you get from song to song?
You know, there are probably people that have a lot cooler ways of getting from song to song. A lot of people will only have the time code active that they are currently dealing with, you know, because basically I have each one in the time code pool. Each one of them's a different song. Some people have a master time code that activates the smaller ones inside the set. For me, I needed Pitbull to be able to play the show in whatever order he wanted and be able to call it up. So every one of those is a different song. And in fact, some of I have like three or four that are three or four different variations of the same song where he might have cut out a verse or something like that. Later, and that was an initial reaction. Later, what we ended up doing, depending on how severe the cut is I actually have the playback guy go in and snip the time code out in the middle and squeeze it over. But it lighting doesn't like it so much. You lose that transition that I've worked so hard to program because it just snaps the next thing. But if it's one show where maybe he has a guest artist or maybe he just has to cut it short, it's a super quick and easy way to do it.
So the audio guy has a different time code track for every song?
And you can do it different ways. A lot of times they'll give you all the time code. Gabe and I found a very long time ago that we are not, that's not how we operate, and we won't allow the clients we work with to do it that way. You have your playback, we are going to send you the snippets of time code we use. So we do them in 10-minute blocks. So you got 0, you got 10, 20, 30, and we have those time codes in a Dropbox, and we forward it to those people, and they send us the music back, or most of the time we try to get them to send the playback session in Ableton, which is mostly what people are using, so that we can navigate through ourselves. But, you know, we'll have them have either the left or right side be all the track, and the other side be the corresponding time code. Right, but we also know they, and we have a naming convention that it's 10 minutes, you know, and they'll let us know where that is. And, you know, as if you are working as a lighting designer with a time-coded artist, you and the playback guy become best friends. Like, of all the people on the Pitbull tour, me and, you know, the playback guy, Beto, work together hand in hand, often, you know, the most corresponded to person probably on the crew for me. Because it's teamwork.
Yeah.
You know, if both sides aren't in communication, the whole thing falls apart. You know, if he nudges it just a hair, the lips don't match on the video anymore. Yeah. You know what I mean? Everything goes awry. So
yeah, sure.
You really have to do kind of...
So is there always a guy, a timecode guy?
Yeah.
I mean, at least at your level.
No, or a playback guy.
Yeah, playback guy.
Yeah. I mean, if your artist is on timecode, they have some sort of playback.
Yeah, because there's, I mean, then you get into like audio patches changing and...
Yeah, well, I mean, but each artist is going to have a different playback guy. They're going to have a different approach, blah, 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 which is why... We've had issues with the past of them literally taking a huge hour-long strip of time code, setting it down, and then them just putting the tracks throughout it. So we might have a song that starts at 6 hours, 42 seconds, 33 frames.
Yeah.
How are we? What are we supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now we send, and it all starts at a very clear 0 minute, 10 minute, 20 minute, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to use the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it all starts at a nice, clean starting position.
Sure.
And so we have them send that to us. They can send it on a, you know, MP3, plug it into iPod, you do a little splitter.
Yeah.
No one goes in the desk, one goes in headphones.
Yeah.
And you just play it back. And if you mess up, you go back and delete what you just did.
And
a lot of it's like a digital audio workstation where you can take a point and slide it over a frame or two frames.
Just like in session mode in Ableton,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can really finesse it. You can have your intensity curves. You can really go in and mess with some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can record as many tracks as you want. Mm-hmm. So if you do have those little flashes you want, you know, what we ended up doing on the last Pitbull show is I made pages that were just the tricky effects, just the little on top stuff. So I did my main cue stack and then I'd go back and do those.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we maybe play a show where we're not going to be able to achieve that, you go mute those channels.
Ah, okay.
And so they don't play back at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the thing is that if time code gets off or it dies, you need to at least know your show well enough to try to...
So then you're just doing goes where they kind of where they would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult, though, because time code opens up the door for you to put 20 cues in half a second.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? So you might have to do that. And, you know, the first show that I ever time coded, like really time coded, was the Destroyed show with Kyle Keegan. And, I mean, we worked for a week straight, 24 hours a day. It was on average, it would take us 2 hours to time code 1 minute of music because it was so intricate and everything we were doing. And by the end of it, it had like 6,000-7,000 cues in the show, which is great. It was awesome. The show looked awesome. And then he played Camp Bisco and time code didn't work.
Oh,
and I had to try to remember a month later what all the button presses were. Yeah.
7,000 times.
Yeah, and get through this whole thing that was just like insurmountably large.
Yeah. But so that show was just one cue stack that's fired from timecode.
Yeah, I think we tried to break it up into some songs, but the problem was we didn't know what the song titles were. They sent us a set list, and I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
What's yam yam? You know what I mean? Like, it's difficult. But yeah, I mean, in the pop mainstream thing, it's a great approach. You know, when I left Bass Nectar, I wasn't really time coding, much less cue stacking shows. The one time I tried to cue stack something for Lauren, I realized he doesn't play the song the same way twice. So what's the point? You know, now we're trying to reevaluate a newer way to have some levels of time, of not time coding per se.
Sequencing,
but,
maybe.
But see, cue stacking some stuff where, we are able to put markers into his music that trigger maybe the bridge or trigger the intro or something like that.
Yeah.
And that those are generic macros that refer to a specific cue line.
Okay.
So maybe an intro can be in, would start at one, but could be as long and with as many intricate cues as you want, up to like 20.
Yeah.
But every verse starts on like cue 40.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that you leave a lot of open space. And that's a trick kind of, you know, from time coding of leaving these extra space
leaving
for you to expand.
There,
But yeah, I mean, the whole inception with time code is we write a really nice, beautiful cue stack and then we just record it.
Yeah. Okay.
Lots of other people will do more intricate stuff.
But I mean, you could, like, let's say you were a punt guy and you wanted to try this out. You could make a time code and just punt your whole show and then go back and fix it.
Well, yeah. And Saxton did that.
Yeah.
Like when Saxton took a break from Soundtribe to learn all the new stuff and to get onto that, one of the big things he was doing was time coding. And I remember the first time I ever saw anything with time code was coming out to his house in Colorado. He taught me earlier that day how to patch an MA. I flew out there because Bass Nectar was about to take an MA out for the first time, an MA1. And, you know, he showed me a few things so I could get going, but I went over to his house and he was like, watch this. But he wasn't actually sending the audio a time code. He just was recording it, kind of with an internal clock.
Yeah, sure.
So he would press play on the music and press play on the thing at the same time.
Yeah.
And it was just so neat. Because one thing it's going to do, one of my biggest issues with, lighting designers now is that they're not interested in making concerted, serious decisions. Especially in the jam band thing, they're all going to put as many options out there as humanly possible, and that it convolutes the overall direction, you know? Now, I'm also a big fan of everybody playing to their strengths, and if you can work with 1,000 buttons, and I know you make your own
things, I have a lot of
thousands of buttons.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have that keyboard over there that I used to use on Bass Nectar, and it will be a cold day in hell before I take it or any other MIDI device or anything, no external touchscreen. If I can't figure it out with 30 faders and those buttons and those four screens, it's just not worth having. So what it does is really force you into making super solid decisions, and that just the practice of time coding for a punter would be great. Because you have to make real decisions. And it will inform on every level how you approach doing lighting. I think it's a great practice. Plus, once you get good at it, you're super employable.
Of course.
You know?
I guess in my world, my punt world is more like, I don't have 80 buttons to do a bunch of different things. It's, you know, all the colors and all the lights. You know, so it's like, it's just more of a, like an instrument than 8,000 different things happening.
And you know, my business partner in Music Matters, Aaron, I use him for this example a lot because, you know, before he met me, he didn't know how to do lights. It's been a process. He uses the Maxis platform with the M1 and stuff. He's been working on the MA, but his comfort zone is the Maxis. The Maxis does not have a lot of playback ability. It's not super finesse, but he has bought every single one of the outboard units that you like can get in this country. You know, and he is surrounded on basically all sides and occasionally has foot pedals and stuff to trigger all this stuff. And I look at that and I go up there to maybe sit in on lights on something and it's just like, nah, like where's red?
Yeah, sure.
You know, but for him, it's fantastic. And you know, it comes out of that whole thing of we all come from a different place and that we all have different access to different tools at different times and that we have to make the end product be there regardless of the tools that we were given.
The whole reason my console even exists is because I didn't have touchscreens and I needed to do more things, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did my first show at Red Rocks on Light Jockey.
Yeah.
And you know, I love Light Jockey and made a pretty simplistic and oftentimes made fun of piece of software do incredible things and do things that, like, when Fish came back in, you know, 2009, I was just like, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it, you know, it, for me, the process of time coding in the last few years of Q stacking, you know, Stone Sour had to be Q stacked. Animal Collective had to be Q stacked. Like, it wasn't an option for me to rest on what I had actually made a career out of myself for. And I tried.
Yeah.
I tried with Stone Sour to do that. It was a complete disaster. And I was like, sweet, gonna Q stack. But that practice of really making really clear, defined decisions, making a look, making a thing that you know is gonna work. Now, I still have a show file with a shit ton of options. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But in order for that button to stay there, it's gotta be impactful. It's gotta be important to my show.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I have very few buttons that I don't touch. And that if they are on there, I like stare at them with anger and hatred. I'm like, you could be better.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're not paging at all.
There's no paging changes at all. That being said, we have a really sweet system of macros that Gabe and I came up with, which actually will change what's happening on my right hand. Right hand is my driving hand. All my colors, you know, the typical sweep, swipe, swooshes that everybody does.
Yeah.
You know, those are on my right hand. But I don't want to have to press a button to move them the other way, to swipe the other direction or to do that. So on my left hand, I have a set of buttons, a set of macros on buttons that are moving these cues around.
So you just have like left is one set, right is another, and the macro switches which one's on the button.
Yeah, but a lot of it gets into how we like really organize and, you know, based off how a console runs, you can't just delete that line, because then the queue turns off.
Yeah.
So we have a trash folder page.
Oh, yeah.
And it transports it up to a trash folder page, and then we are taking a clean sequence group of sequences out of the sequence pool and floating them into it. And then they have the speed. If you were to do that and throw it in there, the speed is going to automatically go back to zero on your fade because it's what your default is.
Yeah.
Right? So my fade speeds are actually changing a variable.
Okay.
And that when the macro that asserts those out of the sequence pool into the deal is saying, cool, when you do this, the speed needs to be set at said variable.
Sure.
So that I'm able to have a snap, 1 second, two second, 3 second, all of those things are in there.
Okay.
It took a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
If you get even one number wrong in the macro,
of course,
you're screwed. But it's macros. Actually, that macro is triggering three other macros.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it changes a whole set of stuff.
Sure.
Much, much broader than just the all colors on my right hand. It changes the direction on the individual spots, beams, LED fixtures. I have a set of effects that do the whole, like, strobe and go down to an iris at the same time of hitting the color.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so it's switching. I have that effect written five different ways.
Oh, okay.
So it's throwing those in and out. So yeah, it's a pretty powerful thing. Now, we've done that for the last year and a half, 2 years with Bass Nectar, and now I've started to see that there's certain ones in there I don't ever use.
Yeah.
And that I want to maybe change that functionality, but the overall concept of never changing pages or getting confused on where you're at and having this stuff just moving it in and out.
Yeah.
Important note, though, in order to do that, you have to be on the master desk.
Okay.
If you are on the backup desk or something like that, it's doing all the processing on a different thing. It'll be really slow and it won't work right.
That makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, it's not a foolproof system. Sure. It does have issues.
Is it ever?
If you press the button twice, you know, or you hit it and you haven't activated a scene in it, and you do it again, it's deleting the activated scene in the trash folder.
Yeah.
So all your stuff goes off. So you have to make sure if you hit, like, sweep that you actually at least sweep something.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's little pitfalls, and when you're in the middle of it, it is whatever. But
yeah,
it's a cool system that kept me from having to have all these buttons that people have. And I also don't do the layout views.
I was going to ask, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do layout views for focusing.
But you don't do the color button layout
view. No, I do it.
They're very in right now.
They're very in. They're very in. A person we know stolen from a bunch of people in Germany. That whole concept.
Yeah.
And brought it over here. And now everybody thinks that person came up with it.
Oh, really? I just see them all over, like, all over the internet. And
I do the AB color thing.
Yeah, right? I have one that's three. I think.
Yeah.
But I don't even use a layout view for it.
I mean, I just built them as little macros right here. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, I have a beam pump page that's there.
Yeah, so we're looking at, what is this, screen two?
Yeah, well, I have on my leftmost screen is all the beam stuff. Beam specific effects. It does have that AB kind of color selector thing.
So this is like a selection of two rows of macros, one with a different color.
Yeah, so you could do red and white or blah, 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 and that a certain amount of effects in the show.
And those are just copying presets to somewhere else?
Yeah, well, we basically have like a master A and a master B, and that whole thing just in blind stores said preset at those.
Yeah.
I think everybody sets that aspect up pretty similar.
Yeah, that's how I'm doing it.
Yeah, this only, though, affects a very narrow grouping of effects in the actual show, and it's, how do I make that bigger? Yep. And it's really just these five effects.
Oh, okay.
But those five effects, one is it's a color effect with a shutter, it's a color effect with the iris, it's a color effect with like a prism.
Sure.
And it's all them popping in, and those are the ones that my left hand will change the directions that they go into and everything like that. You'll see down here, executors like 111.
Yeah. So these say snap,
sweep, downs, peel, that, and then it's the fade speed.
So the five in the middle set how long you want it to happen, and the five on the left have what direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't impact these effects. Those are actually on whatever fader that's kind of goes with it. But it is a really small part of my show. So my leftmost screen is all my beam specific effects, and they're all laid out almost identically the same, where it's about four intensity effects and then a button using macro button using naming conventions with underscores and all that kind of stuff to specifically turn off beam intensity effects.
Okay.
And then I have, you know, a row where it's color effects or movement effects, and they're all kind of lined up with the individual off.
So you've got four things and then an off at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have intensity, position effect, movements, you know, and then I have a lot more options of color effects.
Yeah.
And then I generally have what I call special, which is like a churn. Saxon uses the term churn. I'm pretty sure.
What, can you describe that?
You're using a ramp.
Yeah.
A ramp up or a ramp down.
Yeah.
Right. So the light is slowly moving into a position and then snapping back to the old position, and then you're taking a PWM pulse width
To turn the dimmer off.
To turn the dimmer off at exactly the point that it shoots down.
Yeah, sure. It's like a rain effect sometimes.
Yeah, the rain effect. But Saxton really got it to. He's the first person I ever saw to use it, and he coined the term churn, which I continue to use, and I will unabashedly say that I stole that shit from him, and he knows it happened, and it's okay.
Yeah.
I changed the direction with which I churn.
Okay.
But he was doing it to emulate this effect that Kuroda did in the 90s when he was using these Altman All-Stars.
Yeah, that spun around.
Yeah, they had a 360 spin, and then that just concept disappeared from lighting for a good long time.
Yeah.
And now it's back, you know, with fixtures, you know. But, it's basically to imitate that. But I've created a bunch of things like that. And with the beams, you know, you can get really cool stuff by pairing up the dimmer and the movement effect.
Sure.
All of the special effects in that category are all just dimmer and movement. There's no color, none of that. Mm-hmm. I don't mess with that. That's what those other five that switch around are for.
Yeah, okay.
And so if you go to like the LED one, it's set up the exact same way, basically.
Okay, yeah. So now we're looking at it similar. It's like a five width cell where the first four are mostly the effects, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And the last one is the kill.
Yeah. I color code it so it hits my eye.
No,
but
that makes sense.
All of these are individual kills of a specific fixture type, you know?
Okay. It's not just the effects that we're looking at that it kills. It could kill anything else in the show.
But only in that fixture type.
Okay. Yeah.
And I really, there's not a lot else that I put in there. I generally trigger interesting effects on a per fixture basis.
Okay.
But what I do have is down here, I have master offs of all color effects or all that. So I can get a bunch of different stuff going. I can have the spots doing one color effect, maybe this other there, and then I can pull out all of the color out of it.
Okay.
You know,
can I see one of those?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this one is just off and then an asterisk and then dot and then everything else is asterisk underscore L underscore CLR underscore FX. So anything that started with, you don't care what the first part is.
Yeah.
You just care about that second chunk.
Yeah. My favorite part about the MA is the naming convention bit.
Oh, yeah.
I know that other folks probably approach this in a slightly different fashion, but this...
We didn't meet this night, but I saw the Bass Nectar show at Electric Forest a couple years ago, and I was kind of like house right, you know, right at front of house, and I remember looking over and being like... Programmer background, because I have a programmer background, so underscores and no spaces is important in my world. But.
Yeah, I mean, I'll credit Scott Chmielewski, who I met when he was programming briefly for Fish, with illuminating me to, one, how powerful macros are, but also just this concept of naming conventions.
Yeah.
And that, I would say that was the number one selling point for me for the desk, was that using naming and everything, I could have a higher level of control to pull things in and out. Because I had the same all kill buttons on my MA1, but the cue had a stomp in it, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's not the same, really.
It's not the same.
It gets messy.
It's messy, yeah. This is a much more effective way. And I mean, I'm sure there's more intricate ways, and we've kind of looked at, you know, maybe a way to hit a big, huge effect and pull stuff out, because like these effects, these are like the whole rig going crazy effects, but I can't pull out a specific aspect of that.
Oh yeah, you'd have to stomp it because
it's inside that cue.
Yeah.
Whereas what I could have done maybe, and what we've looked at, is maybe writing macros into that cue that trigger all the little things
layers,
to do it.
So
pull it out. But
so you don't stomp anywhere in the show?
I will occasionally, just like if it I use my groups as actual inhibitors, mm-hmm. as negative inhibitors.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll go in if I just really need the spots to stop doing something and, you know, do stomp just, and then hit
in
it.
In the programmer.
Yeah. 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 But then, you know, it's in your programmer.
If you clear it.
And you clear it, everything goes back. And a lot of my macros, especially the AB color stuff, the switching, the cues on my right hand, all of that stuff requires the programmer to be cleared out and stuff.
Anything with blind edit. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not an effective way of doing it. So we've really had to kind of like assess that. But again, these all rig effects buttons are the ones I stare at angrily every day.
Because they're the ones that you're trying to get them to really
be something, so that, be something that I really want to use. Yeah. And I find that it's hard for me.
Can you read us some of the names? I like that you're using creative names.
Yeah, well, here's my whole thing. I won't store it until I come up with a name for it.
That's the way I am with my color looks. Yeah. And I have to like the name.
Yeah, if I can't name it, it's not something I'm using.
I found that also if I don't like the name, I won't use it. Like I do a lot of sci-fi planets.
Okay.
And if it's like for color looks, you know, and if it's like a planet that I don't like, I'd be like I would never do like a Tatooine because I don't really like Tatooine. So like if I did one like that, I wouldn't hit it and I would have to rename it. You know?
Yeah, I have a hard time naming things. I really do. I actually on one of my LEDs, I have ACL1, ACL2, and then it just rad ACL. Yeah.
Can you read some of the more interesting ones?
Oh, yeah. I've got party, pastel, club, which is probably pretty similar to party.
Yeah. I like wildfire and phoenix.
Yeah, I have WTF rainbow. and then.
What does that one do?
Like everything's just going ape shit and it's a lot of rainbows. It's pretty much every metal rock star dies as soon as you press that button.
Yeah, Dio rolls over in his grave.
Yeah, I've got RGB Lauren, which basically brings all the lights down on Lauren and does a crazy, and then all the LED stuff shoots out towards the crowd and does an RGB chase. I think I honestly feel like my position names are a little bit more exciting in general.
So I noticed you had those as toggles. How do you turn them off?
You can either just press it again.
But I mean, like, so there's no fade out or anything?
No, there is.
Oh, okay.
You just press edit one time, and it pulls you in. And when you press edit the second time, it'll have an off time.
Oh, yeah. So you have off times built into all of them.
Yeah.
I got
and
you.
Then also, they will turn off if I press my all special off.
And that obeys the off time?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not on, a rate fader. It's just 2 seconds.
No. It's generally just 2-3 seconds. But my band... or my position names are like I've got Cascade Crown.
Oh, nice.
Perched Flight. The Mountain.
Yeah, I have a Mountains one.
Yeah.
And Portal.
Oh, that's a good one, Portal.
Well, I have one, my favorite one, you know, I used to, early on, I would always focus on the disco ball if there was one.
Yeah.
And then on nights when there wasn't one, I would still use the position to get that, I mean, everyone says Saxony, but like the...
All the points to the thing. Yeah. It's okay. It's a very Saxony thing.
Yeah. Well, so now after a while, I realized that I would miss that when there was a disco ball. So I just named it Ghost Ball.
Ah, so, I like that. Yeah. I like that name. Yeah. I mean, I would say that the things I like naming stuff. I have a really hard time doing it. I think the thing that I like the most about my show file and that I'm most proud of is the level of organization.
Yeah.
That's going on.
Is this all the positions?
That's all the positions.
Yeah, that's not as many as I might have guessed, given the...
Well, a lot of things will use multiple, like, ones that will use that, ones that will use another thing.
Yeah, okay, so you're building like you would a color look.
Yeah.
Where these lights are in position, you know, cascade down, and, yeah, I got you.
Yeah, and, you know, these, I've labeled things the exact same way. Mm-hmm. My entire career.
Yeah.
I've always had band one, band two, audience one, audience two, above band one, above band two, sky. They have always been the exact same position for me.
Yeah.
I tried, above band one and audience two tend to give me a little bit more leeway. I'll try to make those more unique. But I added, when I came back to Bass Nectar, those used to be the only positions.
Okay.
When I came back to Bass Nectar, I started adding the ones that were slightly more graphic.
Yeah.
Trying to just do some unique stuff.
Yeah.
But... I'm kind of stuck in my ways about what positions I think look good.
I am too.
And I'm super opinionated about other things. You know what I mean?
I think that's what gives you style, though.
Yeah. Right? So I try to get outside my box, and I look at it, I'm like, nah.
Yeah.
You know? But I still try. So the bottom row with those other ones are all attempts to be cool.
So is there any chance that they maybe make their way to the top row someday?
Not with those names.
Okay.
Those names, because those are all right above my colors on my right hand.
Oh, okay.
And what I do is there's basically a cue stack with band one and band two in the same cue stack with like 3 seconds of fade time between it, and then both audiences are in that, and then both above bands are in theirs. Sky is on its own, and it's basically that big, huge, all-out blinder thing, and that's on like a 10, 15-second fade, I think. And then I have a button that I call long. And long basically bounces from band one to audience one to audience two to sky, then back to band two, to, and it goes through, and it's on a loop.
Yeah, okay. And none of those are on a rate fader? They're all just the hard times?
Yeah, it's 10 seconds or 20 seconds per each move on the long thing. But what I've done is built in delays so that, because the problem is it comes up and it stops. It kind of stops for a second, and I hate that moment where it doesn't
especially
feel...
Especially when it's hung.
Yeah.
The fixtures kind of swing.
Yeah, and so what I try to do is, you know, I like the lights slowly moving from one place to another, and it makes it... It frees up my hands to do other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, to worry about a color or to worry about a gobo or something like that, and still, with Bass Nectar especially, still keep some momentum moving. So what I've done is built in delays and fades that... The first row, like the downstage truss, will come up, right? And it pulls back as the second bit gets into its position. And so that each segment and mood things of lights are on their own little delay and their own little activation. So that you already have lights moving in Q2 before Q1 is actually finished.
Yeah, because you have individual delay times.
So. Yeah, and it gives it a really nice organicness. It gives it a level of like unexpectedness.
Have you ever messed around with the paths in the fades?
So, no.
There's a very unknown feature, but there's a, you know, it's always linear by default, but you can actually set a, like, I like low. Yeah. So it actually will go, it takes slower to start and then goes faster and then stops slower.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
I might have to try that.
And then there are other options too. There's like high, low. So it'll actually like ramp up quicker, you know? But you see that all, like in my show, I see that all the time where, I didn't click the next position quick enough and it stops for a second.
Yeah.
Not on the downbeat.
Well, and if it's gonna stop, it needs to stop purposely and be there. And that can be kind of difficult. But also with something like Bass Nectar, you know, Chris is really good at hitting a look and then he's just doing intensity pops over it and he can keep that position.
Yeah.
But the band's music allows that to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
With Bass Nectar, he's never playing a thing that long. We can't ever really hit that hit for that long. I try to, you know,
you need to
generally long
moving.
Enough for someone to get a good shot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it for the most, I guess, you know, it's a really good night for me and I'm really in the pocket if stuff holds
for a while.
Yeah, you know, if I like want to stare at it for a bit, but the movement tends to always kind of keep parlaying through.
I was gonna ask you, how do you balance lighting for photographs versus for the audience, if you will?
You always hire the same photographer.
That's a good answer.
My next door neighbor is Taylor Wallace of A-Live Coverage. He's been taking pictures of my stuff for years and years and years now, and he's my next door neighbor. You know, he's got shots in Rolling Stones. He travels all over the world taking pictures for all the EDC things.
So he's at every Bass Nectar show?
Mostly every Bass Nectar show. And honestly, he takes all the Pitbull shots and everything. I have no problem paying him an immense amount of money to come out and do it.
Because
you're only really honestly as good as your pictures.
Sure. I mean, in a lot of ways.
And selling yourself to clients and all that stuff. I mean, the video, I don't ever feel like does as much justice as the pictures do.
Well, video is inherently moving.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but he knows exactly how I run lights.
Sure.
He knows when I'm going to stop.
It's so important, man.
Yeah, and we are really, really good friends, you know, and that it goes back to that you need to be symbiotic with everybody that you're involved with and try to find the people that bring out the best in you and you bring out the best in them. I think he takes amazing shots of my stuff, and I think he probably thinks some of his best shots are shots of my stuff. But that's us, you know, having worked together and gained that rapport. I don't think about it. I just know if at the end of the night he comes back and he's like, I got a lot of good stuff, I was like, okay, I did a good job.
Yeah, okay, cool.
You know, but I mean, generally, I try to make it so, too, that the long look, which is probably my most pressed button, because I'll even get it going with long because it's a really low slow fade time, and then go bright, like peel out of it really quick, you know, with a band or an audience position, which is only a 3-second fade, you know, versus the other one, it's moving 20 up, because I want the lights a lot of time to feel like they're about to hit the crowd and then bring it back, you know, or just, you know, I'll throw curveballs in the middle of it. But that long look, I think I like pressing them because you get a constant 20 seconds of cool positions.
Yeah.
As long as the source positions are cool, the places in between them will generally look really nice.
Yeah, more or less.
And I do a lot of like program everything, get all the stuff good, and then go up to the awkward seats in the arena and press that long button because it gives me the ability to see all of it without me having to keep going back over the board and press the next position. Yeah. And just roll through that and see what looks good. You know, focusing in different arenas is difficult. You know, every venue's got its sweet spots of where you can put lights and they won't shoot people in the face.
Yeah.
And, you know, early on in my career, I used to get so much shit about blinding people and strobing people in the face all the time. But it's hard when you only have four lights.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the most effective way to communicate intensity. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but now I'm like, it almost gave me a complex.
Yeah.
So now I like go around and I make sure that it's hitting like at a place where it's not going to hurt.
Terminating like a laser would.
You know, but you also use all those cool points in the venue. I feel like Paul or Waffle were talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talking about using those as waypoints.
Yeah.
You know, to create your focuses is super, super solid technique.
Yeah.
It's way more precise than using your eyeball.
Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
especially on like if you're working on a vertical position and.
You
can't see the vertical, like...
Yeah, you know. it's difficult. I mean, hopefully...
Yeah, especially at 300 feet, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, hopefully you have a super badass production company that comes in and makes sure all your fixtures are pretty close, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, they are, you know? I've known people to take levels and do it. I'm not that guy, but, you know, I'm pretty easygoing.
On some things.
On some things, yeah. Then I'm a huge asshole.
Okay, so what's the, I like asking this one, but what's the trick to the Smalley, you know? Like, if you are, you know, I asked Waffle this question, and I wanted him to say, like, cone gobo, slow moves, but he had a better answer than that, but what's
what was his answer?
His answer was more about paying attention to the song, you know, and knowing how to, like, light the band like it matters, which is a great answer, but I was going for more of a give me the tech, like,
the stylistic.
Yeah, if you were going to make a Smalley show file without your show file, you know, what's the trick?
Oh man, that's a tough question. A tough question. I mean, I think there's a lot of truth in Waffles on anything that you got to service the music.
Oh, of course,
and that's got to be your priority. So, I mean, I would say that. For me, distinctively, the geometry of my positions, I feel like, is something that, while it is inspired by a great number of other artists, that I feel like that people can look at and be like, that's his.
Yeah.
I feel like, especially with the photos and stuff, I feel like the end product is something that people can look at that full statement and say, yeah, that's his.
Yeah, okay.
I think a lot of it has to do with, I like, especially on the arena shows, to have really wide focuses, you know? I want to be really sprawling and really big. I think distinctively I try to do a nice big arch of stuff over the top. I love the way that looks. You know, that's kind of the crown thing. You know, Saxon calls it like the icing on the cake, that top little kind of layer of stuff. And it's something that, you know, we all kind of picked up from Chris as far as the geometry of that. But I tend to go a little bit wider with those and want to make sure I'm covering as much space as possible.
Yeah.
And then I use that almost as like a picture frame of the stuff inside. I feel like even when it's a band, it's easier, but with a DJ, you don't necessarily want to point all your upstage lights on him.
Yeah.
But I try to create, like almost a back wall, that almost ties into that upper arch.
Yeah.
You know,
Cake to the icing.
Yeah. You know, it's and generally it starts with the two center lights kind of right on him and peels wider and wider and wider and pushes more towards the crowd, you know? So if you're using your align function, you're pulling it back.
Yeah.
From where it is. And then the top of the crown is actually, you know, aligned up.
Yeah.
But generally the outside most beams of those end up kind of coming in a similar angle and line with each other. And then you can do a whole bunch of stuff in the middle. But I like a nice base. And I think some of that goes back to, you know, Chris used to double stack his lights.
Mm-hmm.
He two spot fixtures, right? One in front of the other.
Oh, really?
And one, and especially with those altments, one would go and shoot the color.
Yeah.
Just color, no gobo or anything, and then he would drop that cone gobo on the one that rested over it.
Ah.
And then he could split them to create cool shapes, but he would oftentimes ride those two things together. Mm. And that nice back solid color beam thing is really attractive to me.
Yeah.
You know? So I do that. I like gobos and stuff, but if it's all gobos, it freaks me out, unless it's like that all starry night kind of gobo.
Yeah.
I like that. But I want to have something that juxtaposes that and gives it a location.
Sure.
Because I think it just gets too in the ether out there.
Yeah.
You know, I like three color combinations if you can really work it and make it look nice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of Congo. It's my favorite of all colors. And I think it's a really good glue between a lot of different types of colors, as well as magenta is a really good, you can go cool or warm with that.
Magenta. It's actually not, I don't like the color that much on its own, but I use it more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice, you know, it's like the grout between some bricks.
Yes, it's the grout, yeah.
You know?
Magenta on the band, in the air, it works everywhere.
Yeah, you know, I like doing a nice magenta, well, you know, for me, I like bold.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult because if I start doing some color combinations, I'm just like, well, that color is weak.
Yeah.
It doesn't connect enough for me. And I do like pastels. So I tend to try to have at least that grout be very strong, you know, but it needs to be like a transitionary color.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll have that be like a Congo or a magenta. And then my spot fixtures, I love the color white. I love yellow.
Mm-hmm.
I love really bold, intense statements.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to stay away from green in any of my lamp discharge fixtures.
Mm.
If I'm going to use green, it's going to be in an LED or a wash fixture.
You lose so much output.
Yeah, and it just, to me, it looks muddy and looks sick.
Are you not using Color Wheel very much?
Rarely. I use Color Wheel for a color scroll and to create that big rock and roll ending kind of thing.
You're not like, oh, I want the green Color Wheel.
No, yeah. I won't do that. And it's not because I don't like the Color Wheel. I mean,
no,
that's the only way you can get that nice green. Yeah. And honestly, you get these artists like Waffle and Saxton. Waffle did it first with split colors on the Mac 3s. And just it looks so nice.
Yeah.
You know, but it's good for his show and it's good for how he runs his show.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be very problematic from a programming standpoint for how I run my show.
Sure.
Because a lot of times I'll hit a color and then I have a separate cyan, magenta, and yellow effect fader to do
like three different faders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All to do the additive, subtractive kind of thing over it to do my little pops.
Yeah.
You know, I think Johnny Goode from Disco Biscuits, the first guy that showed me that like approach.
Yeah.
And it worked for me, so I stole it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the Color Wheel just doesn't work in my thought process. I did use it a few times on Pitbull, but for a Bass Nectar show, it wouldn't be something I'm super jazzed about.
So what beam fixtures are you using?
For Bass Nectar, it's Axioms.
Oh, okay.
Now,
I have points. Like I live in I've always had Color Wheel. So
yeah, I mean, well, I'll tell you that I'm not a huge fan of beam fixtures.
Yeah.
Across the board, I'm not interested in having a Sharpie in my rig.
Mm.
I like points for what they are, but it's just not when I'm thinking of it, my aesthetic, I want everything to be color mixing.
Yeah.
Everything.
Sure.
So back on the Va Va Voom tour, the last tour I did with Bass Nectar before I left, I used Alpha Beam 700s.
Yeah.
And I used them because it's a nice beam. It's a compromise from the Sharpie. You're not getting the intensity or the throw, but you are getting more flexibility as a fixture. It's a rotating gobo wheel. It has a color wheel, which is fine, but it also has frost and color mixing, most importantly, and that you know, Chris was using those on fish, and they looked really great.
Yeah, those are the scrim lights, right?
Yeah.
I remember distinctly a cool effect he did where they would put the red color wheel in and then scroll. Or no, they would mix in red and then scroll the wheel. And
yeah.
I'm like, oh, they're doing, that's kind of weird.
You know, and that's, I really love using a color scroll on a wheel with like yellow in there.
Yeah.
Or even, honestly, one thing I used to do a lot of was have the CTO in there.
Yeah, sure. Because
it just totally gives it a super organic, warm vibe no matter what color is going through there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I used the Alpha Beams for a really, really long time, and I love those, and I would spec those on everything. And then, you know, the Axiom came out, and it's just a game changer.
Someone was telling me yesterday that the Mega Point is coming soon and that it will change everybody's life. So we'll see.
You know, I bet Greg said that. you know, you find the companies that you like and you find the gear that you like.
He does. Greg loves Roby. That's
yeah, I mean, he loves Roby, but you know,
you'd say you're a Martin guy?
I'm a Martin guy, like top to bottom. Yeah. I mean, they send me Christmas presents. It's super sweet.
Yeah. Well, they're a great company.
Yeah. I mean, the thing for me is that I feel like Martin, one, I know that Martin takes a great deal of consideration about what an actual designer wants and what an operator wants. I know that because they call me.
Yeah.
And I tell them what I want.
Yeah.
And we go out to dinners and they show me new fixtures and we talk about it.
Yeah.
And so there, and I know that Greg has a very similar relationship with the Roby guys.
Yeah.
And Roby makes incredible stuff. The BMFL is what we had out on pit as our spot fixture.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
But it's expensive.
Yeah.
I would much rather have more of some other stuff.
Okay.
The artists I work for tend to be on really tight budgets.
Sure. As most are.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I love the BMFL. I think it's great. But I also love the Viper, and I love Mac 3s.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big, bulky, super slow light, but it's awesome. And maybe that goes back to just me being this idealistic fish fan and just being like, oh, I want that one gobo.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I love the Martin gear. I think the Axiom is a fantastic light. Martin rarely puts out a light until it's good.
Yeah.
They're not into playing the game of being the first out on the market with something, but it be a crappy product.
Yeah.
They're much more into, let's wait until we have a product that's awesome and that will service the industry for a decade, and then we'll put it out there.
Yeah.
I have heard, you know, like the Mythos, I feel like, was a half thought out light.
Yeah, I used them on Thievery earlier this year, and you have to take the CMY module out for some things.
Yeah, so. I mean, and it works. It does some stuff,
works,
you know, but it's not. It was an arms race fixture versus being happy with your business model and knowing that you have the opportunity to put something great out.
Yeah.
So the Axiom, to me, I saw it, and you know, the thing is, it's across the board a great thing because it fits in perfectly with my Vipers. In fact, honestly, after this next Base Nectar show, I would be very hard-pressed to say that we're going to have anything but Axioms. We may not even use Vipers.
Are they bright when in the same mode?
They're much brighter.
Even in the same spot mode?
Yeah.
Wow. Nice.
I mean, I feel like they just cut more. It may not technically be brighter, but I feel like on a I'm looking at the light thing.
Yeah, where it counts.
It cuts. You know, but it's cool to use them in tandem. I had a great deal of success on the last Base Nectar Halloween run of, you know, I'd have all the spots in a band position, but all the beams up in the air to try to create space, not overcrowd stuff.
Yeah.
They'd never occupy the same physical space at the same time. So you can play really well with those. But, I mean, it's fast. It has super fast zoom. The optics are great. I think it has a fantastic gobo package. I would say that on the color mixing side, that it like most short arc lights like that, it's really good at fast color mixing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit jagged on the slower color mixing.
It's
not
choppy.
Yeah, not as smooth. But you know, with any light, I guess you're going to take the good with the bad.
Sure.
You know, Base Nectar is a super fast show, so it doesn't bother me a whole lot.
Yeah.
But I think they're great. And I'm going to, you know, you can put them out on a club tour and have a spot look, have a beam look, have a wash look.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't take that much power. So, you know, the next Stone Sour tour is going to have all Axioms. And I think from this point on, like, Base Nectar will probably going to cut the spot fixtures out and just go with
Why not? Get the functionality.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you know, you never get the super wide, huge, big thing that you can get with a Viper that has, you know.
Oh, so the wide side of the zoom range is a little limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there. It's good.
Yeah.
You know, it will look like a Viper in media in like a medium focus, but the Viper where it can get the super extreme wide.
55 degrees.
Or yeah, and I love that. Yeah, I love that look.
Well, let's do the strobe round.
Strobe round, all right.
Are you familiar with the format?
Not exactly.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. You can take as long as you want to answer, but there's just a bunch of them.
Okay.
So if you want to answer them quickly, go for it. But if we get to one that you want to elaborate on, please do.
Okay.
Okay. okay, old school DJ you wish you had seen in a warehouse rave back in the day.
Book 'em.
LTJ.
Yes.
Amazing. Atmospheric drum and bass DJ, if you will.
Yeah, liquid drum and bass, I think.
Yeah, that's what they would call it now, yeah.
You know, the Disco Biscuits had Spangle and that kind of style as an influence, and Soundtribe had Book 'em as an influence. And
I used to be more of a tech step, but yeah. Hardcore drum and bass DJ, he was always...
Yeah, I love some Book 'em.
What's your favorite subgenre of EDM?
Psytrance.
Ah.
I still think Spangle and anything Simon Possford touches is impeccable.
Do you go back as far as the Goa era?
Yeah. I mean, Hallucinogen, I love everything that dude's ever done. Yeah. And on top of that, he's been such a good friend of me over the years.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think also the offshoot of Younger Brother in there was definitely cool for me because it brought in electronic music into that Floyd kind of vibe. And that's distinctively British and, you know, really great. But yeah, Psytrance, as far as EDM, in general, that's really the only EDM I care about.
If you had a time machine that holds a semi's worth of modern gear, what one concert would you travel back in time and light?
Pink Floyd, something.
Floyd.
Something Floyd, you know. Maybe even just a David Gilmour solo tour. I don't even have to go far back. I just want to go like last month.
Favorite color?
Congo, but in like real life, like purple.
Yeah.
I love purple.
I noticed that your macro pool is colored purple.
Yeah, purple is it's the ancient color of royalty.
Ah,
you
yes.
know, the emperors of Caesar were the only ones allowed to wear purple, and I just think it's an awesome, expressive, multi-talented color.
It's a great color.
And I also like neon green, if you haven't noticed.
Neon green. I mean, that's neon green's my favorite. So do you mess around at all with like LEDs that have a UV channel?
No, I never have.
Yeah. How about favorite gobo?
I like the broken up stars.
Yeah.
The tiny dots. It's just super cool. It's not effective in most scenarios.
But when there's enough haze.
But when there's enough haze and it sets me in there are scenarios where there's no other thing that would work better.
Yeah.
You know, if it's light and twinkly stuff, like something sounds like snow falling, like that's it. And I just love it's the only gobo that isn't in a medium focus on default. It will immediately go to the wide focus on default because I only want to use it if it's like everywhere.
Yeah.
But after that, I like the laser cone, the four prong laser cone kind of thing.
Like four circles and...
Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. But I mean, in general, I use open a lot. I tend not to use the like plasma one, like the glass ones that are just bubbles.
Yeah.
If it doesn't have really distinct lines in it, I don't use a lot of it.
Yeah.
At least on Bass Nectar.
You're sick in bed and can't make the tour. Who do you pick to sub?
Which artist?
Ooh, let's say Bass Nectar,
I would say Gabe.
Yeah, that seems like a logical choice.
Yeah, I mean, across the board, it would be Gabe, just because he's got that, his part of it is being able to run a show. The other part is knowing the music.
Yeah, of course.
So he knows all the music for that. But, I mean, I don't know. There's so many LDs out there that I would just be stoked to say they're going to run my show because I'm sick.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of talent.
If you had to pick another LD to take the show over, not use your file?
That would be such... That's a hard one. I mean... For me, I would say Saxton.
Sure.
You know, just because I think he's really adept. I don't necessarily think that he would want to do Bass Nectar or something like that. Yeah. But you know, I think that he would have a good time.
It's a popular answer on a show. And,
honestly, I'd want to see what he did because it would be so different from what I would do.
Sure.
And in that vein, I would want to see what Greg would do. But I think, you know, no insult to Greg, but I just think that Saxon's would be so wildly different than my approach. And that's what, you know, he's an innovator and everybody cops that dude's stuff. It's cool. He just, cause he's got more.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everybody cops his stuff and then immediately he's like, cool, y'all can have it. I got this new thing I'm doing.
Yeah.
And his attention to detail and refinement, especially with his focuses, and just, I mean, yeah, he's a badass.
Yep.
I'm super, super excited to see what the coming years come for him doing, designing.
Too. I think we all are.
You know, Tiberius is doing a fantastic job out there.
We just got to see their show the other day. Yeah, he's doing great.
Yeah.
But you know, given Saxon's history, I am excited to see what projects he ends up on.
Yeah, well, you know, it's super sweet that the band is super supportive of his decision to grow and educate himself as an artist and expand his repertoire and to, you know, be all that he can be. Sometimes you'll work with bands and when you leave, they're pissed because they feel like you either owe them or that, you know, somehow their artistic goals are more important than your artistic goals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super, super sweet to see the band be overwhelmingly supportive of him and to have a company like Brown Note to back him up.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I've talked to him more in the last few months than I have in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as I can keep, you know, getting to talk to my homie about stuff and, you know, it's great. I think that this industry, that there are people that come in this industry that are competitive and feel like someone else took their gig or, you know, they need to get it from someone. And the reality is there's plenty of work out there if you're, you know, willing to work for it and that you're not the right person for every gig and that the right person generally has the gig.
Yeah.
Not all the time.
But
that you can either go through your life being pissed off someone else has your gig or, you know, that you're not where you want to be, or you can get yourself where you want to be and be happy for the people, you know, that you're working with. There's amazing stuff to learn from every single one of these badass lighting designers out there. This genre has, in my opinion, the most amazing levels of creativity and goodwill. You know, we're all friends.
Yeah.
And it's really great. It's like a big club, and especially during festival season, you get to go out and see all these people and see what they've been doing all year, and that it's symbiotic and it's mutually inspiring. And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, really important to me. And so, you know, when Saxon calls up and he's like, hey, man, how do you handle this issue? You know, other people might just be like, well, I'm not going to tell you. That's like a trade secret.
Yeah.
But I think that's what's cool about this podcast.
I was just
too,
about
though.
To say, that's the whole origin of this podcast.
Yeah.
I want people to share. I share, so.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's important, you know. A lot of people delete their show files off of house consoles.
Yeah.
I've done that once.
Yeah. You just leave it.
I leave it. Dude, you can look at that file all day. You're not going to run a Bass Nectar show.
Yeah, well, that's what I always say.
You know, like, I know that the trick and to my success is what's in my brain and what's in my fingers. Yeah. It's not a computer.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That's just a tool, and there's cool tricks in there. But you know what? That cool trick could have the next badass lighting designer help him get somewhere, and maybe 10 years from now, he's inspiring me to do some stuff.
Because, that's what I'm saying, man.
You know?
That's why I'm here talking to you guys.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's knowledge is power, and knowledge is meant to be shared, and the only way that we get anywhere in this world it, on any level of human existence is by being open to progressing everybody. That's not always been the vibe in the industry,
not always the vibe even right now, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, I'm a very firm believer that, you know, you're only going to make good art if you have a good heart.
Yeah.
And if you're empathetic, and if you can put yourself in other people's positions, and if you can strive for a goal greater than yourself, it's really important to me. It's all about, you know, putting good, awesome energy into the world. And if you do that, you're going to get that back, and the art's going to be better.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Agree 100%.
Yeah.
Favorite color combination? If you had to pick.
It's going to be that like old school Congo and Aqua with a little bit of green that
I like it a lot.
Chris used to bust that out in like mid-97s, and it just like felt like you were in an underwater kind of vibe. I've yet to be able to master that particularly. There's a lot of finesse he puts into that, but that's my favorite. Yeah,
that's a good one. Best buffet in Vegas.
The best buffet in Vegas is absolutely the Wynn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the buffet at the Wynn.
We're planning a trip there soon. We're going to take my mom to see some shows.
The Wynn is the best casino in Vegas.
All right.
I have all the Vegas tips.
Oh, yeah.
I
know. I'll hit you up.
I am an expert on Vegas.
I'll hit you up when we go for some good ones.
Yep.
Artist you would love to light someday. That's still around.
Mumford & Sons?
Mumford & Sons?
I love
Mumford. Man, that would be so different. I would love to see that show.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Mumford & Sons. Yeah. Don't judge me. I don't care.
No, that's all good. If you got that call, that's the one right now where you'd be freaking out.
I would be freaking out, yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily know if I'd want to go forever with them. But
no,
I find they were like my white whale of bands that I hadn't gotten to see for a really long time or ever. And then I got to see them last year at Life is Beautiful. And I like pretty much was just the most vibing for like weeks afterwards.
Nice.
I like know every word to every song. And
nice.
Everything. Yeah. Or Sigur Rós.
Oh, that would be.
On two different sides of the spectrum.
Totally.
Yeah.
But also, I guess, three different sides of the spectrum. If you throw in Bass Nectar in there, they're very different. If you had to build a light rig using only one fixture model, what would it be?
An Axiom at this point. It might be a huge misstep on me, but I'm going to do it regardless. Just to experiment. Yeah,
that'd be interesting to see the management of it. Because, you know, when you have a Viper and a Beam fixture, you just treat them different. But when it's the same, you have to split the file up. Sometimes.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because with Pitbull's Vegas residency, you're required to basically use the lights in house, and it's a bunch of Viper Air Effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. It's Viper Air Effects, and then they have some downstage VLs. So I had to go through and allocate certain Air Effects that I would use as wash fixtures and certain ones I would use as a spot fixture.
And they don't change in the show. It's that the whole show?
There are a few songs where I would get them all down to spot mode and stuff, but it was few and far between because I already was coming in with a time-coded show that had washes and spots. So I cloned over initially and then went back through, but it's twice the amount of fixtures of a normal show for us, and it's an undertaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big rig.
But yeah, you have to, you know, you naturally rely on groups being individual fixture types and that giving you some bouncing around. So, yeah, there will be some experimenting on how to create multiple kind of groups and uses out of the same type of fixture.
If you could never use one color from the rainbow again, what would it be?
I mean, I guess green.
Yeah, who else said that? That hurts me, man, because that's my favorite.
But. I mean, I like it, and I especially like green and yellow. That's like a big go-to for me, but... You know, I feel like...
If you had to pick one, that'd be it.
Yeah, because I definitely use the others a lot.
Yeah.
You know, green is one that when I hit, I'll bail pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know?
Favorite thing to see in the green room from the Hospital Rider?
Oh, kombucha.
Do you have a favorite painter?
I mean, I would say overall, probably like Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
We had one time on Bass Nectar tour in like 2011, we had the opportunity to go to the Dolly Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like almost cried pretty much. I was in a constant state of just like euphoria. It's one thing to see it in print. It's another thing to like see it in real life and see the paint and how it interacts and that level of precision. And then beyond just the skill set it takes to paint something like that, the... just how do you get your brain to be in that space to loosely connect that kind of stuff? And, you know, for me, I would say what's more inspirational to me than watching other lighting designers or going to other concerts is art. I like a lot of different kinds. I like stuff from just goofy cartoon character stuff to graffiti to high-end stuff. I'm a huge fan of like interesting sculptural work.
Mm-hmm.
Gabe and I have been working a lot with this company, Vita Modus, out of LA, and you know, Heather, the main creative there, just you know, really interesting ways of pulling in lines and physicality to create space.
What's your favorite Star Trek program? Like,
oh, next gen.
All the way. Next gen all the way. I agree.
Yeah, because I just like the battle bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Any episode where they got to get in the battle bridge.
You mean like the holodeck?
No. They have it's only like three episodes in the whole series, but they had a special part where they could get the saucer to disconnect, and there was another bridge.
The
battle bridge.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, the rest of the time they were in the cool one, but the battle bridge is how they had the super intense stuff. Because the bridge on the normal ship is actually not on the saucer, it's on the hull right below lower, it.
Yeah. Vegas show lighting design that has blown you away the most.
And Ka.
Okay.
Maybe not just the lighting design,
just
but
the whole
just
show.
How the heck someone can have such a global vision, and the technicality behind what's happening. Mm.
Do you aspire at all to ever work on a show like that?
Yeah, but that's not ever gonna happen.
Those guys are just like so far.
I mean, in my mind, it's my brain just doesn't even work in that collectiveness.
You mean that, like, being able to collaborate with that many other designers or what?
Well, the specificity.
Mm-hmm.
What makes Cirque du Soleil really interesting is that there is an incredible amount of specificity, while at the same time being massively ambiguous.
Yeah.
They draw just enough dots and stuff for you to connect them yourself.
And you don't mean specifically lighting here, right?
No, the entire creative vision of a show. They let your mind connect the dots in a respectful way, but they lead you in a very specific way, and that it's an incredibly psychedelic thing, that tiny balance, and that their best shows have that balance.
Mm-hmm.
The shows that falter are where they get too literal, or they try to guide you too much, and they don't allow the narrative to be felt versus spoken.
Yeah.
And so in that, you know, the costume choices, the set choices, the lighting choices, everything about that, what acts are going to be during things, the music, all is informed by that specificity of ambiguity. Mm. So a show like O, while being visually pleasing, these set pieces are coming in while other pieces are moving out, and there's, you know, the lighting is architectural while at the same time being, you know, concert-ish.
Mm-hmm.
There's just such a wide range of skill sets that all come together in a harmonious way that you don't think that there's any other way it could ever be. Mm. You know, and then for me, anytime I see a piece of set or a piece of lighting or anything move, I freak out. Automation is like my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Well,
you mean you love it.
Yeah.
Do you ever use it?
It's a budget killer.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it really is. You have to have an artist that like feels like they need it too, because you will, you know, a person who makes that just move once makes more money than me three times over.
Wow.
You know what I mean? It's very, very...
Well, there's so many safety issues.
Yeah, you know, you got with all of this, you got safety,
yeah,
you know, concerns and people's lives. And when you don't do it right, people get hurt.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think the shows that I like and the shows as a lighting designer that I really attach to are the ones where they're doing stuff I don't know how to do.
Yeah.
And that not only do I not know how to do it, I don't feel a particular urge...
Makes sense, yeah.
I like the J-Lo show. I love. And it's funny because I went to the J-Lo show the first time I saw it. I've seen it twice now. But the first time I saw it, I'm on phone with my business partner, Gabe, texting him the whole time, just being like, I am such a terrible designer. Like, how does he do this?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like they don't do what we do. They take a certain group of lights and they use that for a song.
Yeah,
or it's much more theatrical. There's no big looks. There's none of that. The whole approach is completely 180 from an aesthetic, from what I do. And that just gets my mind rolling.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me guilt trip myself a bit. But what was funny is Gabe was actually having dinner with Corey Fitzgerald, who designed that show.
Oh, really?
And was telling him about this. and he texts back.
Not while, like, you were texting him, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
While I'm texting him, just being like, oh, this show's so great. I'm
just
terrible.
Wait for song four,
like,
yeah.
No, he texts me back and he's like, it's cool. Corey's sitting here saying how he doesn't actually know how you do the thing you do.
Yeah. You guys should do a collaboration.
That would be cool.
That would be cool.
That'd be super cool. But
also, I should probably have Corey on the show, right?
You should definitely have Corey on the show.
Yeah, can you make that happen?
Gabe could.
Okay, cool.
Gabe's real.
I mean, I don't know Gabe, so you got to make the Gabe thing.
You should get Gabe on here too.
Oh, definitely gonna have Gabe on. Yeah,
yeah.
We decided that after Greg. Favorite way to spend a long layover?
Oh, God, this is going to make me sound bad. At the bar. I like a good beer. You know, the problem is if I'm not in the bar, I'm going to be in one of those stupid gadget stores buying stuff I don't need.
Yeah.
I have more headphones than you can shake a stick at, and I don't need any of them.
Yeah.
I end up if that or I'll end up buying shoes.
All right. Well, my last one for the strobe round, I guess, which wasn't that strobe-y this time, but I like it. If you had to find a new career, what would it be?
Yikes. That's tough because I'm just not good at just about anything other than this.
Would it be technical? Would it be artsy?
I do like technical stuff. I mean, if I couldn't be the lighting designer, I feel like I could be equally happy being a crew chief and just building the thing.
But what about not in the industry? Like, you had to find a new industry.
An architect.
Architect, okay.
Yeah.
It's a good side answer there.
Yeah, I would want to be an architect. I like the concept of structure, and I really dig architecture. Sure.
Got anything else that we want to touch on?
The one key piece of advice is to go do your best work every single time.
Yeah.
And make no compromises to that. And people will see that, and people will recognize that. And if you are always, always doing your best and holding yourself up to a professional standard and doing that and understanding it's a job, it's not a hobby, you know, and you approach it with the same level of professionalism you do anything else. Be on time, be courteous, you know, be prepared, but always do your best to the best of your ability. Some people's abilities are different levels. This industry has all those levels. You can work at all of them and be happy. But if you're always doing your best, you're going to be successful. And be kind, treat everybody the way you want to treat, and don't ever tell somebody to do something you haven't done yourself.
This has been episode 4 of The Light Side. To find out more about me or the work I do with Dogopod, check out lukestrattondesigns.com. Thanks for listening.